Blog Talk Radio.
Looks like we're shy of one horse.
You brought too many.
Thank you.
knocking on the door, 1,600 shows. Not bad. Anyway, good evening, good evening, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Hump Day Special. Courtesy of your friends here at Soul Tree Radio in the Raw. I'm your host, Michael Lewis, singer, DJ Honeycomb. And as always, it is good to have you in the house. Soul Tree Radio in the Raw, proudly sponsored by BASNNewsroom.com and the Assassin of the Black Athlete Sports Network. You know, the good shit. The who, what, when, where, why, and how, right now, at www.BASNNewsroom.com. Shout out to the members of the Brother Man Network, wherever they may be. Hello up with our brothers at the African-American Athlete. Ricky, Mike, Tim, what it look like, y'all? Hope y'all doing well. Ricky in Detroit, I got in California, East Bay, Tim in Atlanta, our brother Radio Reggie and his puppy, hanging out in Richmond, Virginia, Stephanie in the Mighty O-Bar, and Stephanie, happy anniversary, guys. Continue blessings and much, much more. Yeah, cool couple. Love you both. And the professor, Fred Whitty, down there in North Kakalaki, somewhere in the smokehouse. Take out some ribs and shit. I got some greens I got ready for cooking. And other good stuff like that. We'll all be around to chew the fat, as it were, and kick out what should be a rather engaging episode, but we always have to deal with the sad first. To help me with that, my brother, the bad man from the East Bay, Gary North Gray. What up, G?
It's a great day for Dodger baseball.
Yes, it is. Shit. He had been doing that almost as long as I had been alive.
You know, the first game, I was 1 year old. 1 year old. I know I was a guy starting. That's amazing. That is amazing.
That is amazing. You know, Vince Scully comes from that group of guys who would get on the air and paint word pictures as he was accounting what was going on the field. I think he, Red Barber, when he's a redneck or not, and a couple of the guys helped to make baseball what it was because they helped translate the action on the air.
Well, you know, Michael, I can remember when I was growing up, maybe you guys the same thing. But around 10 o'clock at night, I would be laying in the bed.
Uh-huh.
Going up and down and down, up and down and down, getting baseball games.
I hear you.
I would get KDKA Pittsburgh. KMOX St. Louis. I would get that now and then.
Yeah.
And you can't do that anymore.
No, you can't do that anymore. Those big ass radios that were like furniture, I did the same thing because I used to get Jocko from Philadelphia, and then the signal would carry over into Chicago.
Yep.
WABC signal carried all the way up to Canada. We found that out when the Beatles hit here in the 60s. But, you know, on the dial, if you turned it just right, you'd be amazed at what you could turn up with. So, yes, you know, that was the golden era of radio and Scully. And Dodger baseball made that whole thing popular. You know, I could not listen, really, in all honesty. I could not listen to a game on the radio. I liked the idea of seeing the action, you know.
Yeah.
The only time I actually listened to a game where I loved it was when the Yankees and Bucky, you know what, Dent, beat the Red Sox.
Bucky Dent, yeah.
That was because I was at work. And the redneck, who I really did not like, was a Sox fan. But having said that, you know, Scully made the Dodgers beyond what they were as just an ordinary baseball team. He helped make them an institution. And I'm sure certain guys in certain parts of the country did their bit in enhancing the myth of baseball as the grand old game.
I remember we were in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And going to Oakland for Seattle.
Yeah.
For 3 days, the Yankees were playing the Oakland A's. And it was the Golden West Radio Network.
No shit.
Every night we was the Yankees against the A's back in 1969. And you know, both of those teams, the A's, but that was fun.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're able to generate a powerful signal like that, and you happen to have a popular product, you do tend to attract folks. But Scully's voice was cool because he gave you the action. He knew what the situation were, he actually helped you learn how to score on a baseball card, because I remember listening to a game or two where, like in baseball, if I wasn't playing, I was bored as fuck. So that helped me to learn how to score. And I appreciated the scoring aspect of it. So sitting back and listening to Vin Scully do his thing, you know, it wasn't so bad. But it seemed as the years carried on, especially in the 80s, when Fernando Valenzuela became a Dodger pitcher, as my brother turned the corner. Yeah, I mean, it was Fernando Mania, and Vin Scully wrote that puppy like I don't think.
Yes, he did.
I don't think, you know, it would be hard to argue, but let me go to my baseball brother here for leadoff. Tony, good evening. And, you know, we have to sadly start this off as Dodger baseball takes center stage with the death of Vin Scully, dead at 94 years old.
Think of this, guys. Vin Scully saw Jackie Robinson and Clay Bellinger.
That's right, he did.
Think about that. If that's the one link, he is the. I mean, he's the link. I mean, technically, he is the link for, you know, our ancestors.
Yeah, Jackie Robinson, right?
In regards to, you know, when you think of prominent moments, whether it be in Dodger history or just in baseball history, Vin Scully had a hand in a lot of it. You know, one of my favorite calls of him is when he the Hank Aaron 715 on the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows his humanity. Let's put it this way. When MLB TV first came out, one of the things that they offered, and they still do, is just the radio feeds for all the games. I bought that every year for at least 15, 20 years before I was able to, just so I could have the ability to, on a given night, hear Vin Scully.
Oh,
that's
shit.
Something that, that, that's something that, back in the day, if you were a Dodger fan in St. Louis, you couldn't hear Vin. If you were a Dodger, and see, that's the one great thing, I guess, about the modern times now is that it gives you the opportunity to, listen. Like, as I'm speaking to you guys right now, I'm doing something I usually don't do, but I just wanted to do it tonight. I'm watching the I'm watching the Padres pregame show, and needless to say, it's Soto and Bell today, Soto and Bell tomorrow, Soto and Bell forever, and
oh,
I'm
man.
Anxious to say, and it definitely looks like they got a couple extra people there tonight because I'm not saying it's not a sellout, but it's not. It's, let's put it this way: it ain't a throwaway game with the Mariners on a Wednesday night. You know,
shit.
They got a few folks.
It'll be interesting to see how the attendance in Dodger Stadium and Oracle Park up here in San Francisco. You interested to see how you say this work out next 2 months?
Well, and see, what's also interesting, the Padres visit D.C. later in the year.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
So his first trip back will be interesting. But to get back to Vin, I mean, look, there are probably – I think there are about a handful of people who, especially back in the day, not now, there isn't anybody now. I mean, I'll take that back. I do like to check in on my buddy Dave Sims in Seattle.
Yes.
I do like to check in on the brother in Houston because there's not too, there ain't too many brothers doing it. But the only other than the three amigos from the Mets, i.e. Lindsey Nelson, Bob Murphy, and Ralph Kiner, there were only two other broadcasters who I would try to listen to either locally or nationally. One, I'm not ashamed to say, is Howard Cosell.
Yes.
Two, the other guy was also Vin Scully. See, the thing is, there are people that know him from his golf calls. He was the TV guy on CBS for the catch, the 49ers and Cowboys. And he nailed it.
And there's just
so many, like baseball moments. I talk about the Hank Aaron one, but there's also the night they honored Roy Campanella, his first trip back to L.A. And there's basically this is the old L.A. Coliseum, and everyone is in there with a candle, and it's very moving, it's very touching. As much as the game, I know a lot of people, every Met fan today was little roll of the third. Yeah, I get it. I understand that. And we'll always remember that. I always remember Murphy's call too, as well.
Yeah.
But that's the thing with him is that literally he is probably, it's funny because, with Russell passing as well this week.
Yeah.
Thing is, there aren't really many people on either where there's such an age gap where they can talk about Russell and whatever and actually know what's going on. That's the difference between Vin Scully. The fact that he was the voice for baseball during the postseason, whether it was on TV or on radio. Plus he was a freaking bulldog. He was still doing games by himself.
By himself.
That's right.
He could not you know, I've only done like a handful of play by play or what have you.
Uh-huh.
And to do that by yourself, oh,
he was doing
all the
mind.
I'm tired just thinking about it.
No joke. I really appreciate going to later though.
No, go ahead, please.
I'm sorry. I really didn't appreciate Scully until Fernando showed up. When Fernando Valenzuela hit the turf, and it was Fernando Mania, I mean, Scully worked that bad boy. I mean, he made you like Fernando Valenzuela, even if you hated playing against him.
Absolutely. And see, you know, again, he saw Fernando, he saw Don Newcomb, he saw Don Drysdale, and you know, all those Koufax no hitters, you know, two and two to Harvey King. You know, everybody's
That's right.
The whole, you know, and it's his little stories. I mean, there's a thing in there where he says it's 9:37 in the City of Angels, and he said he did that because he wanted that if Koufax had that, you know, in a time capsule or whatever, he always wanted him to know whatever. And see, the thing that I got from him was, I think even up till this day, he would have an old-fashioned egg timer. You know, like the pistols.
Right.
And he would turn it over, and basically, after it's filled up, he would always tell you the score in the inning. And to me, that is something that some of these morons that are doing games now, I mean, we're so jaded now. Well, especially for radio, but TV, it's a little bit different because they got graphics all over.
Right.
The sad thing is they put more emphasis on graphics with a side dish of baseball in regards to that. But with radio, you know, when you like, you know, the thing was his thing was always somebody could be just turning on the game and they wanted to know the score. I mean, simple stuff. It was not, it was understated, but just common damn sense, you know?
Yeah.
I can remember 5 years ago, I come on here, Fox Sports was doing a game at 1 o'clock, specifically, 1 o'clock Eastern time.
Mm-hmm.
I came on here, it was about the eighth inning or ninth inning.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning of my show, I always did the last inning of the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was so exhausting. I could not believe these guys would do this every day. You gotta be kidding me.
Yeah. It's, you know, the thing about it was that, I mean, he literally was as great as he was, he was the most understated, he's the most understated broadcaster of all.
Yeah.
Because he
it
just
was never
did,
about
you know,
him. It was never about him. I love that aspect
of
him.
He always said, hey, my thing here is to let, you know, at the end of the day, I describe the game. I let them know that tickets are still available.
That's right.
You know, you push Dodger Dogs and all that other stuff. And that's it. But see, he literally became an instance. Matter of fact, I was listening to, there was a story today. You know, we made the reference to the old LA Coliseum. They actually played in that freaking monstrosity back in the day. And the whole deal was everyone brought in a transistor radio because, especially the Coliseum, because because the game was being played in L.A., but you were probably watching it in San Diego because of where your seat was. He would have to tell – he had to actually go on the air and say, turn your radios down, because he was getting feedback.
Feedback.
That's,
yeah,
I mean,
right.
Think of it. Think of it.
That's
there were
impressive.
90 – up there was 9,500,000 people at the game, and pretty much 99 3/4 of 100 were listening to it with Vin. And it was such an impact because it gave feed, it put feedback into,
I can believe that. Yep.
This thing. It's so understated, but just so huge though. I think that's the thing, you know, he was in his humility, it was so basic. It was so basic. You know, you could damn near listen to a broadcast of his from those early years in Brooklyn, and you could listen to ones from the last. And, yeah, the inflections might be a little bit different, and he might be a little bit slower, but the basic principle of how he did a game, it never changed. He was still that 22-year-old guy from Fordham doing the games, even when he was in his own press box in L.A.
Well, I went to Dodger Stadium. I was about 14 years old. And walking into that stadium, I heard his voice everywhere. I mean, everywhere.
Yes.
You go to the food stand, you go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm.
Well, then, if it was like that, Gary, then they made maximum use of it, and they really did a smart thing, because he knew how to hold your interest. He wasn't trying to do anything more than let everybody know what was going on in front of him. It wasn't look at me. It wasn't catchphrases. It wasn't stupid things. It was just like, damn, you know. It's not a bad game. And even if there was nothing going on, he made you want, like a good book, to turn the next page and see what was going to happen. You know, and that's what a good announcer does. That's what I loved about Pat Summerall and Chuck. Mm-hmm. They were awesome in that aspect. You know, you even had an idea what you thought was going to happen. And even then, you were still excited because of the way they were able to relate that.
And with all due respect to John Madden, John Madden, and he was great in his day, but you know, give me Brookshire and Summerall.
Yeah.
You know, two former players. You know, they would cut up. They probably cut up more away from the field than they did at the games. But again, what made them cool, and what makes a great broadcaster cool, that, you know, like you said, they don't. It's not about them. They're there to give you that work. And to a certain extent, with TV is much easier because, let's face it, you know, everything's right there in front of you.
There's
so many times when I'm flipping on YouTube, I'll just like if there happens to be a Summerall Brookshire game, I'll listen to it just for a couple minutes. Just to be like, yeah, I remember that back then.
I used to do that too.
I mean,
CBS had an history of going Philadelphia, New York, and Washington.
Yeah,
was always their main game.
You got to remember. Summerall, like you said, guys, Summerall and Brookshire basically they spent most of their career with the Eagles and the Giants.
Yeah.
And in a sense, those were the two sort of flagship teams, because
CBS
CBS had the NFL for flicking for.
Mm-hmm. Years, yeah.
And you know, even when the Giants were god awful, the Giants game was usually the nationally televised game. I clearly joke about being abused as a child, being forced to watch Jets, Giants, and Patriots, basically the majority of my, formative years in football. And it was nuts. But I didn't really realize until later when you realize that how important the Giants and the Eagles were, to put. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, the first overtime game, of course, Giants and Colts. And one of the first major documentaries, and it even predates NFL films, is the violent world of Sam Huff.
World of Sam Huff. Yep. Excellent documentary.
That thing ages well because it's still very, very prominent. And it's funny because the Giants were very instrumental in the history of the NFL in regards to TV because it was still that major market. And think about it. We always talk about Summerall as, being a prominent guy, but you can't forget Frank Gifford either.
Yeah, Gifford did a decent job in his role and stuff. We've just been blessed with people who seem to understand what it was to speak on the action, and I include Kurt Gowdy and Aldi Regattas in that as well, as the professors joining us. They really knew how to lay out the action in front of everybody. And even every now and then, they would play with the audience. I mean, play in a good way where, Aldi Regattas, what do you think they're going to call here on 36? And, he would relate something and stuff like that. And, even when he was wrong, it still looked like, oh, damn, they're into the game too. So it was like,
it got people guessing on what they were going to do.
It was inclusion without delusion. People had an idea like, yes, this is a game. And if they're just learning, they help them feel more comfortable with the aspect of learning the game. That's what I liked about them. They were teachers. The other guys is like, you had to know something about the game, but they were teaching. Let me let the professor in on this right here. Professor, good evening. And, of course, it's a sad day because we're talking about Vince Scully and, of course, Bill Russell and talking about later. But, I know you're a baseball fan. When did you first hear Scully?
I don't remember because I didn't pay that close attention to talking head back then. But I do remember, I do remember him and a few other guys over the years that were good. And the kind of stuff I look for in football and basketball as well as baseball, every damn pitch is not the best pitch ever. Every pitch is not the best catch ever. Mm-hmm. And right on down the line, And those old guys like that tended to, it was a sorry pitch. It skipped three times before he got to the plate. He needs to do something. That's what I always look for. I would never blame the catcher if the ball didn't get to the plate. Mm-hmm. But we see that in some of these clowns now. I watched the one play that a Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback threw. I won't call his name because he didn't last. But he couldn't have caught that ball if the goalpost was sitting over there and he had a net. Okay. But the receiver should have gone after that. If he'd have gone after he did it, he'd have landed outside the say to you.
Mm-hmm.
You see, those are the kind of guys I hate. And
yep.
that, and see, those are, for the most part, these last 20 years. The last 20 years, and maybe even 40. But the guys from way back, they honored the game in the way they called it. And, you know, Mr. Dodger was one who did that. I mean, he was gracious to the players on both teams. It didn't matter if it was the home team or a visiting team that was not so high on the list of friendlies. He always paid homage to the good players. He had a knowledge of history and a sense of what was truly valuable to the games that he was able to deliver. He could deliver the same kind of game with 10 runs scored or a two-way
right.
no-hitter.
Mm-hmm.
And those are guys I love.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and remember, those guys would not be yellers like they have now.
Yeah.
Lights cast now, you know, and I pay attention to the little things, like I'll listen to a game that Charlie Neal does. And I listen to the game that the other guys do. Charlie is Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And the old heads are where Charlie learned his craft. And Charlie, you don't hear Charlie going all AWAC and, you know, again, saying stupid stuff like that's the greatest run ever.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
No, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right about that. You know, I find it interesting
that's why I got annoyed with the Yankee broadcast. With that guy who tried to rhyme.
Michael K. I never realized how easy it was for me to literally turn the, you know, I mean, look, the mute button is my friend because, and again, I don't say this, I literally don't say this to be arrogant or whatever, but I think all of us on the thread here have no problem listening to the or watching the game without the sound because we're all smart enough to realize that, hey, we know what's going on. What's that?
It's true.
I said you use your mute button. Mute button.
Please. It's I mean, look, like I said, right now there's literally like a handful of people that I may want to quote unquote listen to, and a lot of it is more just out of, you know, respect and just because, you know, they're friends and what have you. But
that's right.
To me, when Scully retired, that pretty, you know, he was the last guy that I was gonna like that I would actually turn on the game to listen to. You know, with certain Mets games and with certain Knicks games or whatever. But even with like the Knicks, once they screwed over Marv, I was pretty much done. I mean, no disrespect to Mike Green, but or Clyde, who does a very good job. But Marv
put his personal business out on Front Street. You know, if he had just stuck to broadcasting, he had been fine. When everybody found out what a kinky little freak he was, he caused his own problem there, and it had nothing to do with being on the air. You know,
Sunday nights, Marv Albert would do New York Ranger games.
Yeah,
Sunday nights.
Yeah.
I would turn radio on, do my homework. Monday morning school, Monday morning. So I would turn on WABC and do my homework. And it's the Ranger game. Every day.
Yeah. We got Radio Reggie in the mix there. Reggie, can you hear us?
Yeah, guys, maybe I
Excuse me, peace and blessing, deacons, for the sense of justice. Thank you for all that y'all do. But you know me, I got to put cold water on this thing. Yeah, I hear everybody talking about how Marv was, I mean, Vince Scully was so great and everything. But my argument is, Sonny Hill, if you had a plethora of young black men and women who were given the same opportunities in that period, time period, who knows who would be the greatest? We see that with sports. And, you know, yeah, you know, Vince Scully painted this nice picture. And, yes, he was good with words. But, you know, what did he do to, should we say, further human rights? I mean, did he befriend Jackie Robinson? I mean, you guys are historians. Y'all tell me.
He actually did.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. I don't know.
Oh no, he actually did. Mm-hmm. He actually did. And I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying, Reg. Here's the thing. They're out here now. I mean, Gus Johnson has carved his own, niche. I remember. Here's the thing that I think a lot of us have sort of forgotten. One of the better basketball analysts from back in the day happened to be a fair to Midland guy from Louisiana by the name of Bill Russell. He was the voice of the NBA, from what I can remember, late 60s, early 70s on when ABC was doing the games, and then in those early years with CBS before he had to physically beat Brent Musburger's stupid ass. But that's another chapter. In and of itself, but that let's put it this way, it may not be as many, but they're out there. They may be on other different levels, but I mean, I'm thinking of guys like Hal Jackson in New York. Who's the brother that did the games, Fred, that used to do those games for A&T for the longest time, Mr. Swan. And his partner Billy Covington. Those guys were there for years. I mean, I look at somebody like Al Roseboro, the voice of the CIAA. His legacy is there just as prominent as Scully. But, I don't want to, it's not that we're not forgetting about our black ones, but, I got no problem giving Vin his due. I have no problem at all.
Yeah, I think there was some connection between these guys, because the guys you're talking about that used to do A&T games, they're turning over their archives to some people who. I mean, we're going back probably 30 or more years.
Absolutely.
That's why we're building the Heritage Center, because my thing is having black control. Now, it's a good thing, but the great thing is for us to control our own destiny. As well as control our own property.
Absolutely.
Kind of things we're looking at. And Reggie, you're right. We do need to make sure we honor the ancestors as well as the ones that are going through now. Because when you take a time to look at, say, where, he's still wet behind the ears, but he's growing. And he has a chance to go in and listen to all these other guys and produce an improved product, because he has a chance. It's so much easier to do that now. Look at the stuff that Doug Gates is doing. When Eric Moore came on board almost 40 years ago now. He literally took HBCUs out of the dark ages at a time when they were ahead of him And they were probably ahead of most white schools because I can remember doing stats. And they had like a 7-man squad down on the table. And we had two people.
And Professor Charlie Neal, I put Charlie Neal against Vince Scully anytime.
Oh, I would too.
Absolutely.
I know this will be blasphemy, but I have no problem doing that.
No, it's not blasphemous at all.
No,
it's
about being good. No, we're talking about the Europeans. How dare you? That's Vince Scully. You can't do that. How dare you?
But Rez,
it's just a joke, guys. It's just a joke.
I know, but what I'm saying, but see, they're going to do that. We know that's their modus operandi. That's, again, and I think going back to what Fred was saying, it is incumbent on us to do the same for our folks. You know,
I agree.
And it's not like we don't have it, because I was lucky enough to do a few years with Bill Franklin, and one of the guys that was working with us is a guy by the name of Tali Carr. Now, him and another Winston-Salem grad, Steve Gaither, basically run HBCU Game Day now.
Who's another state announcer just passed away this week? It's a Norfolk State basketball announcer. He just passed away this week.
I heard about that, but I don't remember his name. But Reggie, here's the kind of stuff we're looking at. On May 11th, 1975, there was this gentleman that spoke at Winston-Salem State's greatest of all time graduations. That man was Dr. Frank Bannister. He had the voice. He had the call. He had it all. I mean, even speaking at graduation, there was just a thing about his voice that was mesmerizing. He was great. He was great before there was even that many guys out there. And there was a few others out there spread all the country. But remember, there was only about four or five games being broadcast on a national or even regional basis back then. Because, if you weren't at the game, your next best chance was to catch one of the black newspapers and see what they did and work from there. But, see, now we don't have an excuse. If you got a phone that's anywhere above, say, a flip phone, and probably even some of them, that couple of my nieces and nephews have, they can work with that thing. It's incumbent on us to tell our own story, and because we're going to, we just got to use what we have and work forward. That's all the Indian guys back in the day. Some people don't recognize it the way they should, or at least that's how I feel about it. But it's on us. You know, you, me, the whole crew here. The crews on some of the other locations, we have to do it because T-Mac and I, we can probably hook you up so you all can listen to the next meeting of the HBCU sports pro sports the T-Mac Kelvin.
HBCU Pro Sports Media Association.
It would be a good idea to
continue those talks about.
Yes.
Because I got to do my poll stuff tonight before
I
go to bed.
It takes a little work.
But it's doable. If we don't do it, then we can't complain.
It's doable because you must know your subject matter. I got Eric Satterwhite in the mix as well.
What's happening, Mike? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good.
Hey, but Mike, I want to throw something. Okay, when I was at the NEAC Media Day, It was amazing how the young men was nervous when I was interviewing them. And I'm like, you guys should be nervous. I'm just Reggie, you know, reporter, you know. And to hear the stories of the South Carolina players talking about how they had the two teams side by side in the championship game, Jacksonville versus South Carolina State, and they almost got to fighting in there. That's what nobody talked about. They said they had them literally sitting next to each other. I don't know who dumbass came up with that idea, but that was just a brawl waiting to happen.
Well, you know what? But you know what, Reg? It's a testament to both kids, to both schools, because you know, unfortunately, we saw that happen a few years back in the CIAA,
we know, Professor. I know about Virginia State, Virginia Union. I mean, Virginia State and then
a few years back with
Winston State and that other school.
Hey, brother Reggie, let me ask you a question. Was there any other subject matter other than fighting that you got from that conversation?
You know what I got, in all honesty?
Yeah, let me hear you. Because the fight thing, come on, that's 24/7.
I was real impressed with the players, how they controlled themselves, how they conduct themselves, and how they held the energy for game day. I was real impressed. So when I interviewed the quarterback and defensive end, they kept saying, man, we never felt so disrespect. And even on the football field, my man said, the defensive end, he said, I never talked so much trash to a person in my life. He said, I just wanted to knock these guys' heads off. And again,
what was the conduct like? Was it a good forum? Was it positive information?
Everything was positive.
There you go.
Yeah, everything was
think about
everything
young people today with anyone with a microphone, the way social media flies, there's going to be a precariousness.
Yeah, but they were very respectful. They were very appreciative of the media being there. Dr. Cavell was there, of course, ESPN, and we had a press of people there. And what I liked about it was they gave the media a chance to sit down and talk to everybody. And then, of course, when the big boys, ESPN, rolled up in there, you know, with Jay Walker and everybody else, they had a separate room for everybody to come in. So it was a little better organized this year than what it was last year. So I also get to see the Celebration Bowl trophy, and I got to hold that. And I said, I don't give a damn. I'm holding this bitch. And they kind of laughed and joked and everything.
I watched a lot of all four online. And look, the whole TV versus other media, that game's been going on for years. They always treat TV differently. I'm not, you know, I don't condone it. I think, to be honest with you, it gets kind of tiresome and old because, as I'm pretty sure y'all will attest to, TV, it's still sort of a new thing for these TV folks. You know, the more hardcore folks, whether it be internet or your daily newspapers or your local and national folks, they've always been there for the HBCUs. What you hate to see happen in some instances is when they sort of turn their back on the folks who have always been there for years, as opposed to the TV folks who, they've been there to a certain extent, but unfortunately a lot of times they only come if there's an agenda and what have you.
Right.
Now, granted, because there's more coverage just overall, they're more prominent. But there's as is with a lot of white media, they're still late to the game. They're always
and I'll say this about the commissioner. When I interviewed the commissioner, like she said, I mean, we just, you know how I do, folks, you know, hey, yo, commissioner, let's just keep it 100. She said, people just got to get off my back and stop running up on me. We got a plan in place. She said, we're not just going to set up any school, because case in point, A&T and Hampton rolled up into the Big South for 2 years. Now they're gone. And A&T is getting ready to leave out and go to the CAA. That really hurts the Big South. Now they got to try to juggle just to have 16. A&T is staying this year so they can have 16 so they can play in the playoffs. But after next year, they got to find somebody to take A&T spot.
So
the Big South is really falling.
It's a process. But I think the thing, I think the thing is, especially, you know, when you see how the SWAC has grown, you know, the fact that they basically, you know, literally took from them, I mean, they basically did a Texas-Oklahoma going to the SEC thing with the two Florida schools. And remember, those
they
are...
They
were
Nino Brown.
Well, yeah, and see, it's even crazier because they were, you know, they were original MEAC schools. So it adds even more to it. And look, the MEAC sort of had some self-inflicted wounds along there too, in regards to how they dealt with it public relation wise. But that being said, I'm sure she has a plan, but I think she's just trying to keep it low key more than anything else. I hope for their sake that they do, you know, within the next year or two, you know, get it so that they're at least prominent again. But let's face it, the SWAC did their homework and they're reaping the benefits of it. And you hope at some point the MEAC catches up. But see, again, it's like old money versus new money. You got to remember, the SWAC goes back. The SWAC had a 40-50 year jump on the MEAC. So in that instance, they're always going to be playing catch up to them. Now it's just a little bit more prominent than before.
True. And you have to have people able to turn the page. If we go back to what we were talking about regarding Scully, folks who know that the game is the most important thing, and they won't let that get in the way of how they translate the action on the field so that people stay interested. I think that's why baseball was able to keep a leg up for the time that they did, because they had people in certain parts of the country that were able to run those little word pictures out in such a manner that they fascinated not just their own audience, but lay audiences elsewhere. I want to go from there into Bill Russell and say ashe to our brother, because there's no more defining story than a trade which definitely changed the history of basketball. People forget about the fact that Russell was a trade on draft day, essentially. I think it was Ed McCauley and that racist piece of shit, Cliff Hagan, went to St. Louis, where the other rednecks were. Russell goes to Boston. Not that Boston was any better. And the rest, as they say, is history. The fact that Russell became the... I'm sorry, go ahead, Tony.
I think that the two things to me, well, more than just two things. The thing that stands out to me, in a 13-month span, he won national championship,
yes,
gold medal, and an NBA championship.
To piggyback
on 13, he played 13 seasons, won 11 titles in those 13 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the other thing. And again, and if this sounds like us tooting our horn, so be it. When we put together the BASN Newsroom Facebook page, there's only one picture that we've always had as our cover page. It is the iconic picture of the Sports Summit in 1966.
That's right.
Kareem Lou Alcindor, then Lou Alcindor, Jim Brown, Len Ford, Bill Russell, a bunch of other prominent black sports figures at the time, all basically given the then disposed champ, Cassius Marcellus Clay, a.k.a. Muhammad Ali, a chance to speak for himself and then also speak for him. It is, to me, in many ways, that is even more iconic than the debut of Jackie Roosevelt Robinson, you know, breaking the color barrier, because it took it to that next level. And I think I'll say what I said on our Facebook Live. Bill Russell is not just one of the most prominent sports figures in all of America. He's one of the most prominent black men of our generation.
No question. No question. And a lot of people forget that. He was the second black man to coach a team to a championship, you know, at McClendon being the first in 62 with the Cleveland Pipers. What I like most about Russell is that he wasn't trying to play the humble blah, blah, blah shit. You know, you got what you got with him. He did what he did. He wasn't appreciated. Of course, they did that after the fact. Oh, Bill, we're so sorry. We didn't respect. Fuck that. You know, he was too busy winning. He was too busy getting on with his life. That you got to like and you got to respect that. Eric, I think Russell, more than anybody else, made the NBA appreciate the fact that you can be who you are and still be successful in a work environment. And I mean, you know, as far as the basketball players playing, he came in there, showed them not just how to play, but how to deal within the structure of the game.
Yeah, all that's true. I mean, I think that the inventory and how you categorize, you know, William Felton Russell in many ways in terms of the basketball exploits, then there's been this common denominator out there. Oh, you know, all the humanitarian things, he did this, he did that. And, you know, they can point to supporting Ali and the pallbearer for, you know, Jackie Roosevelt, Robinson, things of that sort. So all that's, you know, the trimmings. But where I like to take it, just based on, you know, my intrinsic connection with basketball for many years, just on my, you know, literally access and upbringing, and what was shared to me as what's really relevant. And basketball was always the last thing, because there's a lot of people can hoop, right? A lot of people can ball, you know, and that's not an unusual skill set. And right now there's probably a guy who's coming out of high school who would serve, you know, most of, you know, the players from that era if you compare skill sets to a point where it would be embarrassing. That's just how it's advanced and how good it's gotten. It's just not seen that way because of so-called old mannerisms. But that era's passed. But back to Russell, things I like to point out, too, is that I've always shared, you know, consistently, you mentioned about Coach John McLendon of the Cleveland Pipers, you know, who won that first championship and was the first to win three national championships in a row at any level, which catches the attention of all these people. But Russell, as he was known, you know, he was rare in the sense that the people didn't even understand at the time that, you know, Brothers wasn't even wearing goatees, you know, and he was playing with a goatee. And that used to stand out, like a bald head would stand out with slick locks, and sitting down was common denominator. Now, facial hair is no biggie. I mean, the brother would show up in games wearing a cape. You know, I mean, he was well-dressed. He wore capes, you know, games that he threw up before every game before he played to get ready. That was a ritual of his. But a couple of standout things. When he retired in 1969, and when asked, this interview in the document, what was his favorite championship of the 11? First thing he says, the one I won as a player coach. Still
there you
very light. Still very lightly talked about the player coach aspect. Then in 69, you know, he retired, you know, so he never got to face Kareem. You know, Kareem came in the following year, but he was a mentor. And the thing was, is that he had his jersey retired in 1972, not officially, but he made sure it was an empty building when it was retired. It was a private ceremony. He wanted no fans. He didn't want any fanfare. He didn't want any hype. He did not have a so-called public ceremony with all the hype about getting his number honored until 1999, 30 years after he finished playing. Now, you know how people want to be garish and gaudy and hype, get attention. He should be here. Russell was like, F all that. He refused his first entry to the Hall of Fame. He refused it when he got voted in 5 years after his career. And he said this. He said, well, you know, I have a cousin named Bob Hopkins who played at Grambling, right? And he was a dynamite player in the SWAT for Grambling. I was his cousin out of Monroe, Louisiana. And Russell always said that he was better than me. If he's not in the Hall of Fame, I don't deserve to be here. Now, much like a lot of brothers, you know, we've talked about, you know, what took place with the St. Louis Hall. and, you know, what happened with Brother Hill, Cleo Hill, you know. The thing was is that Hopkins brings the same fate in the system. What made Russell well is that, like Robinson, Arbat and Ricky had the cojones to back them and center their game plan around them. You know, Cousy was an asshole, you know, because he was from Holy Cross. And when Russell was going through his stuff, he was Mr. Toast of New England and shit all those years. And Russell was carrying them, and Russell was dealt with all that, and yet, you know, he talked years later about, yeah, in crybaby tones, I could have did more, you know, when I was a teammate, this, that, and the other. So Russell went through all those kinds of scenarios like that, but more importantly, you know, with the hype and the fanfare, he averaged, you know, 15 points for his entire career. You know, 15.1. You know, Chamberlain would have that in 3 minutes. You know, and the thing is, he knew, Heisen tells the story, Tom Hines, former teammate, former substitute championship coach, would tell the story of how when he first met Chamberlain, he said, "We'll just destroy him." It wasn't even close. We just had never seen Russell get handled like that. So what did Russell do? He befriended Wilt. You know, they eat dinner before games. He's slipping Wilt, you know, Russell slipping Wilt. You know, Wilt was slipping, right? So he outside Wilt, you know? Yep. And so that was the advantage he had in winning those games because Russell was about to win. Russell had a cover story in his playing days called The Psychology of Winning. Well before the mental game was ever mentioned. So the brother was a mastermind. So they can run the stats down. They can run, but the character, I remember brother said the first time he seen Russell, you know, in Madison Square Garden, blew his mind. I said, "Who's this number six?" And plus, he had an incredible wings. But if you look at highlights of Russell, some of these, you know, features that he had very long hands. So, you know, now he talks wingspan with players. But he'd always have, like, in a resting place, he'd have both his hands, like, rested, like, where his kidneys are, right? So his back and lower back, right? Mm-hmm. You know, which is not an easy stretch. Unless you got long arms. Try that now. Try putting your arm around you on your back and hold your kidney from the backside right above your waistline. Both arms, he's holding that, and his arms are out like a bird.
That sounds like a double hernia. That sounds like a double hernia for me, Eric.
Right, exactly, exactly. And so Russell's length, they call it length, his arms and his leaping ability. He ran the 440. He won the high jump, but he didn't
high
get the 5-3 flop. He jumped over the MF, you know, and so what he did at USF with winning the national championships and then what he did at the Olympics and then what he did in the NBA, you know, he's talking about the master of winning, but see, those who win want understand one thing more than anyone else ever will understand, the winners. They understand what is called the psychology of winning. These Coach McLendons and these gentlemen who win all these championships, they got the edge on these people. Because they roll out the same way. They practice with the same balls. They use the same tools. They recruit the same players. But why does certain organizations, certain people always seem to win? You know, it's other teams, they can't get it together no matter what they do. And so he had that psychosis. Well, and all the Celtics players bent their will to his mental power. And that's what I like to leave it, that focus that on with William Felton Russell, Russell Powell.
I like that. I like that. I got Patrick Farrar in the mix as well. Patrick, can you hear us?
Love and living, Color Post. Good to be with you.
Yes, indeed.
We're going out.
Yeah, we're talking about Bill Russell and the fact that Russell did so much by just being what he was, where he was. I mean, every son in the league had the same pretty much job description, jump up, get the damn ball, pass the ball, score when you had to. But Russell made it an art form. And as Eric was talking about, the mental aspect of the game made him a superior player because he outthought folks. Who would equate strategy with playing center? But, of course, he was doing that since college, so he was way ahead of the curve. And I doubt very much if all these so-called experts who sit in the press rooms will sit there typing that copy, ever type that out or put that out there. They never accepted Russell for the cerebral assassin, next term, Triple H, that he was. And I think he really was. Much as I like Wilt, Russell always seemed to have the advantage because he was just so clever, and he made the best he did with what he had.
Mike, when it comes, it's one of the things about Bill Russell that if we can point to press room and the people who had the task of writing mm-hmm. about the game because they felt they know the game better than people who play it.
Yeah,
Russ's middle aspect, in a large sense, was put in a form of being aloof. It was
mm-hmm.
aloof. They couldn't handle an intelligent man who didn't acquiesce to their insecurities. That
mm-hmm.
scared the hell out of them
mm-hmm.
to this very day. And I think in terms of TV, and I'll never forget when Russ was doing stuff with ABC, guys, the critique on Russ was that he had too many gaps in his critique.
Mm-hmm.
Russ would, you know, give a response on, and then laugh about it, and then he'd take his time in explaining what the aspect of the individual was in his game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in TV, you know, you have to keep moving. You know, you have to
right.
keep things. But they didn't understand that. And you know why? They didn't want to understand that because, as you all know, people want to frame how a brother is based upon what makes them feel comfortable.
That's exactly right. You know,
well, Patrick focused on the comfortableness or lack of, you know, the thing that has always been so ridiculous over the years is that even when we're right or whatever, people still feel the need to want to make the enemy comfortable, and it's like why
mm-hmm.
you know.
Russell, to that point real quickly, Russell was the kind of person no one really ever knew anyway.
Exactly.
And he was comfortable with that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so, you know, no one really ever knew Bill Russell, you know, I mean, because of his motif. He liked keeping that mystery. That was also his edge.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've seen mm-hmm. him as a person, you know, that would cackle and never would brush his beard or, you know, I mean, sometimes he could shape his fro up a little more on TV. He didn't give a hell about any of that.
Sure,
you know,
mm-hmm.
he didn't care about any of that because, you know, he was at a level of depth. The only time he would come even close to expressing his viewpoint is when he would write his book. You know, Second Wind,
yeah.
really good book. You know, he
mm-hmm.
opened up in his book where you didn't think that's where he was coming from, personal relationship. Like, there's footage of him having, like, this dye
mm-hmm.
ring on, right? You know, and
yep.
his thigh chick cut him. You know what I mean? That's
mm-hmm.
why he had the thing on there, you know. And it was someone he was in a relationship with that he talked about. It was just he couldn't shake it and, you know, it got a little violent and he got cut. And that's why he wore that, you know, and not because he had a hamstring injury. And no one his teammates never knew. And so
mm-hmm.
his whole styling was to keep a distance. But, you know, to go through a full season with no assistant coaches and win the championship, every
yeah.
NBA coach in the league at that time of the year, you know, just needs to just hurry up and shut the door, you know, because they failed miserably. Again,
mm-hmm.
he'd go out there to jump center, you know, where Dak King could have all the balloons ready in the forum, you know, at the time, LA Forum, when the Lakers played. You know, when Wilt went out on a knee injury and shit again, questionable, right?
Yeah.
And they won. He was
Maybe.
The head coach. He was the head coach of that thing.
Yes, he was.
That's
and
right.
I would look at the sideline. So you're, hey, so he walks out for the center tap. There's no one on the bench directing the team. You know how much command you have to have against athletes who are very successful because they wouldn't have been successful. At some level, every NBA player was the man. And wherever they
mm-hmm.
came from, they were the man.
Mm-hmm.
They were the toast of the
That's
man.
Right.
They may
mm-hmm.
have been a 12th man eventually, but they were the man at some point, at some place in time where, he, you know, a hoop legend,
right.
per se, right?
Mm-hmm.
And them guys are all in synchronicity and harmony and in lockstep with Russell. Their coach, leading them, dumping center against Wilt. And they, you know, again, you know, the fact that so many more people want to gloss over that, that's the basketball part, since they love the sports part. You know, they love us to be jocks, just talk jocks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. That's all they want to hear about. Yo, he can ball. I mean, come on. We've been seeing that forever. Man, this cat, we know that your ball better than someone we see in uniform at various levels. No one ever knows. We know them. And we know they were just as good as anyone. Right? And so here's this guy named, you know, William Felton Russell. You know, I'm just saying out of respect because he's transitioned. And you look at that from the standpoint of leading a team. See, we talk about leadership again, man. We talk about longevity. I will never not stop harping on the fact that whatever they may say about any particular player, how great they are, you know, Joe Namath never took the Jets to the Super Bowl as the head coach.
Thank
you.
You
know. You know, Ross Peyton Brown, I don't care what name you
use. Took him as a quarterback, too, but that's another old
I like that, T-Mac. I like that, T-Mac. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you know, I like that a lot. Ali Boumaye, what the hell? And so the thing is that, you know, I hear you, G. So when you see that, man, and the fact that for him to do that, guess what he had to do? He had to shield this. He had to shield that supernatural component of what he really was, so they couldn't really figure out he was that dude.
I
and
agree.
And he did that and didn't care. See, they learn these guys being around the Coach McLendon, because Coach McLendon roll in like 5'5", right? Need us all get out, no swearing, sharp, eyes glow, look you in the eye, drop. Now, I mean, I have conversations with him, and his mind is moving a million miles per hour,
Eric.
And he's giving me, like, information that's, and I know he's opening up to me on a different level because of the familiar relationship thing, but I'm realizing, man, these cats don't know you. You're giving them what you want to know. Your success is how you're going to let them know you. And then even then, they won't know you.
There were a lot of cerebral brothers
in the league. And you're cool with that.
There are a lot of cerebral brothers in the league, but they could not dish out what Russell was offering. What you're saying about control was so true. You know, he had all that laid out there, and it was like, I ain't going to do any more than I'm asking y'all to do. So when he did what he did, everyone followed to what he offered
up.
Allowed for that synchronicity that you're talking about. Everybody knew, don't try to do no more than what you're supposed to do. And we got this. And that's exactly what happened.
We're going to ride with Russell. You got four Hall of Famers. Like, real quick, hold that thought, please. You got four or five Hall of Famers on that team, right? You know. And they had locks up. Don Nelson was an outstanding NBA coach for a long time. You know, innovative, they couldn't get him. He was mimicking Russell in the best way he could do it.
And what he could
interpret from Russell. And I think he retired as the all-time winningest coach in NBA history.
Yes.
All right.
It's amazing that you said that, Eric, in terms of leadership, because of the fact that, as we all know, I was talking to somebody recently about, you know, some of the craziness that people are putting together relative to guys in the NFL now, you know, all the BS I want to put out. And I said, yeah, you guys are talking about the ability, but what about the leadership? You know,
right.
Who's going to establish that? You know,
right.
Forget, and they want to attach to all these damn quarterbacks. Most of them are mediocre in the first place. But who was a leader? And, you know, like Rick was saying, Russ made that, established that undoubtedly. And in a way that, you know, when you talk about, you know, who's the best of all times or whatever, and it kills me. But he had 11 rings, and he sold all but one. So, you know.
It took him 30 years to do a public ceremony. 30 years. Take a public ceremony for his retired number. The Hall of Fame elected him. He said, listen, my cousin ain't in the Hall of Fame. He's better than me. I forget what kind of pro career. If he's better than me, he's in the Hall of Fame. You think I want to be up in that seat? He meant it. But the thing is, dude was always on the chessboard, man. So a guy like Russell, you know, if you go against him, you know, like you think he's coaching and maxing X's and O's as a coach, right? I mean, Russell, you've got to bring the anvil for a mosquito with him. Yeah. The moment you get on an even playing field and you think you want to play competitive level, he got you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he masked that so well. And his players knew it on how he practiced. You know, Arbach managed it well. He wouldn't let him practice certain ways and certain things. But the Celtics have been around him enough energetic-wise that they just would do certain things because, again, player coach, you have these players who, all these Hall of Fame players that play for the Celtics, they got their egos. I can ball shit. You know, I'm good. Who's this black man? Uh-uh. It didn't work. They rode with Russell to the very end. The Celtics players loved Russell.
You know what?
When they were in St. Louis, and St. Louis Hawks didn't want to play a game. The brothers had couldn't eat at a restaurant. The fucking Celtics all lined up. We ain't playing this exhibition game. They bailed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Leadership by example and then some was Russell, and yet he still would not fully disclose his whole project, man. I mean, dude was masterful.
Mm-hmm. And so many brothers had the opportunity to do so, but
Correct.
They never seized the opportunity to roll with that. Now,
Correct.
I've never been a Dallas Cowboy fan, but I had always been a Dwayne Thomas fan. Dwayne Thomas understood the game on a level very much akin to Bill Russell. And because
evidently.
He's black and in the South, yeah, evidently, they wouldn't leave him the fuck alone. They tried to play into a stereotype, and they suffered for it. And I know because Tom Landry wouldn't have spent that much energy trying to get somebody to conform if he didn't think it was worth it. You know, then you had a guy like Marshall Faulk who really understood football, understood all the
nuances. Very brilliant.
But he had a stuttering problem. And when he stopped stuttering, he went into asshole mode and became an idiot because he was sniffing at some white crutch and lost his fucking job. I have no sympathy for you, stupid motherfucker. But, yes, there are many guys.
Yeah. The thing that I think quote-unquote athletes aren't given enough credit for is being artists.
Yeah.
There's the mental game. And then there's the physical game, but
That's right. You
have to have a sense. You have to have an artistic sense of timing, of knowing the intricacies on and off the field and whatever. You are an artist, and I think the thing is, they still really don't want to give that up. To black athletes, so like Eric was saying,
That's what makes Russell exceptional. Russell was a band leader.
Exactly.
Randy Moss totally was a Randy Moss
totally
was a jazz
different.
Musician. I loved him like that. And so was Jim Brown. But Russell was a band leader. He would say, Randy, you do this. Jim, you do that. We got this, blah, blah, blah. And they would do it.
It's your band, Bleak.
If you look at Arbach, right? Every time they win, Arbach rushes Russell on the bench, off the bench. He knows. He knows where his bread is buttered. He knows where he's going to win championships.
And you know something else, Eric? One of the things that we're all seeing is the fact that I give you a perfect example. When we talked about baseball before and why kids, a lot of urban kids don't play the game for a lot of different reasons. But one of the reasons I have to explain to me why black kids don't play basketball and goes back to your statement, Tony, about artistry. In basketball, you know the fundamentals, but you can add your personality to it. In football, you can play football,
Absolutely.
But you can add your personality to it. In baseball,
Absolutely.
It's kind of tough, and it's important that you mention that. Artistry, they're artists.
In all expressions, having scouted for many years, right, and, you know, doing drafts and, you know, having NBA GM for years, you know, Sam Presti followed suggestions to the letter with the Durant, Harden, Westbrook drafts when those guys weren't even considered. Durant was the no-brainer when Portland took Oden, and, you know, all three of those guys won the MVP. And I can go on. Mm-hmm. Two Bob Myers from Golden State, you know, I mean, he spoke his team to the draft suggestions there. Twardzik from Portland, Petrie in Sacramento, San Antonio. I mean, I've had dialogues, you know, with player evaluations, you know, and the thing is that when you look at player evaluations, you throw out any favoritism. It could be your blood brother. He can ball, you got a rating. Or what he does, you know?
That's
and
good.
So not everyone's an artist, though.
Absolutely.
Everyone's an artist, though. You know, Dr. J was going through it. Freaking space velocity vortex with the net when he took off and his throw went backwards. You don't see people doing that shit. What's pushing back his throw? If he travel, what velocity is he traveling at? See, what people don't see that the other man sees. He comes with a show called Sports Science, right? They have to see, oh, Sports Science, and now they're measuring the velocity and speed of ball travels. It's always been there. Coach McLennan and these people understood that way before these people understand. So did Russell. You follow that point? They ran track and they did timing.
If I hear exit velocity again in a baseball game,
That was for you, T Mac. That was.
I appreciate it. I'm gonna get my Buford Pulsar special on them because I can't. I can't.
Joe Don Baker style. We're gonna go to the original. And so with that being said, you know, it's an aerodynamic thing. I mean, your cats, could, you know, would come back and see Dr. J taking off the blacktop doing the same shit on the wooden floor. Yeah, up there in the rucker. You know what I'm saying? At places like that. And, you know, go commingle with people like that. So the thing, again, is like when you look at that, again, the key is what separates that. Do you, and I'll say this. I don't want to steer the subject matter. But could Deshaun Watson use a leadership consultation? I would think so. Can he ball? Sure. Can we go through a litany of people that we can say that to and say that about we know can get down? Could Jordan have cleaned up his act and shit? Yeah. Could he have had to really come to yo, bro, we got a rap, man. You know, you don't need to be, you know, hitting the casinos like this shit, bro. You're losing $57K to golf hustlers. You know what I mean? That's a poor character trait and shit. You know, you
that's
ain't
right.
representing.
That's actually a weakness. To get that,
that's my point. Degenerate. It's almost to the point of being almost to the point of being a degenerate, right? And so, I mean, Mike Tyson said it best. A guy asked Mike Tyson about something about good or something, and he goes, "Yeah, like trying to give credit to someone being good at, like, say LT because he could ball, right?" And Tyson said, "Yeah, I mean, he's good at what he does, but he's not good overall." You know, and see, we speak to a guy like Russell who stood the test, good overall, and then that's where, you know, LeBron James, no father figure, grew up with no father figure. How did he pull off what he's pulled off without that? When everybody, how did he pull that off? He has no problems in the street. He has no character issues. He's worth a billy, and we hate him. How did he do that? You know what I'm saying?
And his mom was whack.
Right. Obviously, to me, obviously, a lot smarter than they give her credit for. A lot smarter than they give her credit for. But she'll take that. Someone had to take the hit. You know what I mean? It's about the knowledge, right? But she obviously put something in that young man that's unshakable. So the thing is being, that's my
Come
point.
On.
And the thing is, I mean, the thing being, so, you know, we know that a person, I mean, I know Cass got some issues or challenge. I mean, we all do, fuck it, and not just me. Or got some challenges in other arenas of their life, right? And
Absolutely. They
came up with this concept that's really fast. This brother told me about this to look at this one time. You know, Jackie Chan, I ain't know Jackie Chan. He said he would play in this movie called The Drunken Master, right?
Yeah, and, I remember that.
And his superpower was getting drunk. That was the shit that made him undefeated. You know what I'm saying? Now, that's not everyone else's medicine. So there's cats or people who got a little bit of edge, a little bit of dings in the system, got roughed up somewhere, but, man, they on a whole other level about certain other aspects and able to be a catalyst and bounce off and transition things. So a dude like Russell, we honor him. Other than we can run his championships off, we can run his exploits off, we can run all those things, the greatest winner all off. What was the mindset that sustained that longevity? And by the time he was coaching the Kings out here in Sacramento, Seattle for a little bit, he was at the IGAF level, the I don't give a F level at that point of his career.
Yeah.
He was collecting the check and shit, you know, and he was just looking at these dudes like, you know, how do I coach these guys and tell them how to play when they weren't raised in the rudiments that a guy like Arbach who knew how to put a roster together. You
remember,
see, and
we
you can't do that.
We call this guy that was from Western Kentucky. Maybe, Alec, you remember, or Mike, you remember. He was all, I think his name was McDaniels.
Jim and Dye.
And he played for the Seattle Supersonics.
Mm-hmm.
And while Russ was coaching. Well, I forgot the brother's name from Ohio State. He was on the team with him. So, midway through the season, you know, he's a first round pick. He's with Russell, you know, and all of a sudden, he ain't playing. So when the season was over, so I asked my man, he came back, you know, we play a pickup games, and, you know, around this, in campus and whatnot. And while I was seeing him, you know, I asked him how he was doing. I said, what happened to Russell McDaniels? How come he wasn't playing? He says, he paid him not to play. What?
Mm-hmm.
He paid him not. I have never heard that before. But that's what Russell was. You can't. You're not playing well today. You just sit here. We'll pay you. Somebody else told me when you're first one pick, now you're gonna play whatever. But that's the kind of mentality you had. If you can't play, you know, sit down and watch.
Different dude, man. You know, and a lot of people couldn't resonate or, you know, calibrate with him. No one's going to run up on Russell and say, you know, that was his boy close friend. Even Casey Jones, right? Because Casey played with him at USF.
Mm-hmm.
And Casey got about, what, 8 championships? I mean, he may have 9 or 10 as a coach, assistant coach, and player, right? He was assistant coach with the Lakers when they won that 33-game winning streak, that Bill Sharman team.
Yeah,
that other
Bulls
team
in
Russell. Yeah, he was assistant coach there.
Yeah,
we know he won at Boston.
Yeah,
the Bullet. Yeah, him and Al Adams was the first brother-to-brother Bullet final.
Yeah, championship.
Final, you know?
Yeah,
world championship.
Yeah.
Yeah. But KC, you know, was Russell's teammate for many years, you know, through those years, Olympic teammate as well. And you ask KC, it's, you know, how well he knows Russell, it's going to be a coin flip.
Yep.
They just, Russell wanted to be measured by everybody by one thing, character. The other thing he never did was sign autographs.
Oh,
that's true.
Yeah.
He was notorious about
people.
That.
Most folks he didn't, yes.
He was like, shake my hand, holler at me. And so I think once in a while he opened up a little bit. I think maybe he did a little, you know, one of those three memorabilia things. He may have did a memorabilia things, and, you know, that was worth $1 billion because of the fact that it's so rare. To have. So
Kareem tells a story about how, you know, he got to know Russell, you know, as a rookie, and it took him almost 40 years before he could feel comfortable enough to ask him for an autograph, and he gave it to him because that was just the kind of relationship the two of them had. I guess they were sort of because you know Kareem was the cerebral. As well,
yes,
maybe
indeed.
Not on Russell's
very
level, but I think he saw a little bit of him. It would have been, you know, it really would have been interesting to see the two of them at the peak of their game go against each other. I mean, you know, everyone always talks about, you know, his battles with Will. But it would have been interesting to see what he would have done with Kareem.
When Michael Jordan lost his father, you know, and well-known knowledge of that tragedy, his go-to support person was Bill Russell. That became his mentor. Out of all the people, it was him and Russell linking up. You know, Jordan won't go too on blast on talking about that because Russell will push back on that. He don't want the props.
Sure.
He don't want the hype, you know. But the thing is, that was the relationship. And what Russell did during his playing career, he went over to the mother country many times and established business liaisons and other relationships before he was even considered popular to do. Now they got NBA Africa. Well, you know, again, Bill Russell, you know, was
a long time ago. Yep.
Long time ago, before the jump off, you know, which again won't link back to him. So he's always about the, you know, from the roots up, and you know, really, again, man, I mean, astounding ways to look at certain things like that, but he wasn't about to kiss ass. That's why I feel like what we talked about, we're going to honor his legacy and talk about those certain things, but we also want to talk about the character, the intellect, because it's huge, and talk about that because it's people that possess these gifts that now, you know, we can talk about a little bit more because they never wanted to uncloak that because if they ever had one inkling he was this smart, he would have never got through.
And you know, we got go on, Mike.
No, I was going to say, the thing that I loved most about Russell was that ESPN couldn't say anything about him. See, they had built, they built up their brand on Michael Jordan. Michael was like Sonny Liston. He was their bitch. He made sure that whatever he did was counteracted with something stupid that he did, so he was under their thumb. Russell was never in that position. That's why when David Aldridge says that he was the greatest one of all time, everybody at ESPN shut the fuck up because they had no control over Russell. They couldn't say he was wrong. You know, it's like, yeah, by the way, we forgot. And you don't really hear the mouse talk about Russell at all during next. I mean, Tony can probably vouch for me on this, but I never got the vibe that they were pro-Russell.
Mike, you know something? I can't I can't quote it verbatim what Mike Wilbon said. But basically he says, he started his expose talking about Russell. He says, this is for all you people, all you geeks out there talking about numbers. They don't matter. I said,
that's right.
When it comes to Russell, they don't matter. Don't even talk to me about numbers. I said, if you don't understand what he is and what he's about, don't leave the numbers alone. You don't know nothing about the game. I said, there you go, Mike. There you go, Mike. Big time.
I mean, you have more rings than fever than fingers, you know, in an era where people, in other words, you know, you got to put two, and you got one on your thumb, and you got to double up one ring, one hand with two rings, right? And so the thing being is, in this era, he never won a ring. He never won a ring. He never won a ring. Oh, he's right. We hear that ad nauseum in this era, right?
Yeah.
And so then you do the measurements. Okay, so this guy's got 11, but you got to run down Sam Jones because that's 10. KC got 9 or something. Zach Sanders got 7 or 8. You know what I mean? And, you know, and Zach Sanders, you look at the stuff. He in Columbia. He went to Columbia U. New York U. When the last time you see someone from NYU to Purple Ace to go to the pros?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it was all these cerebral brothers that he put
Jim
that McMillan squad together,
yeah.
And that's why they won, because everyone can ball. It was in the league, but what you had, because Jackie Robinson was talking about, you know, when he was in the Negro League, the thing he was talking about oftentimes was, you know, because he was, you know, the great Rachel Robinson was always there for him. You know, she's 100 years old. Congratulations, you know.
God bless her.
You know, power to her. Power to her. You know, and so the thing is, it's like that was his, Jackie Robinson's strength was her all those years. We see that. We know that. Right? Held him up through all that bullshit. You know, and so the thing was, because he had that rare support level, he was blown away with what he would call the carousing of the Negro League players. You know, right? The lack of discipline, you know, just being out in the block. And that was so anti him because based on what his home life was like, right? That's why he had to be that linchpin person, to be that representative person, you know, that went through that league. Because the carousing ain't going to make it, right? They don't make it nowadays, actually.
Yeah,
long term and shit, you know. They get caught up in the side action, which is 24/7, and it's a cheap way to go because that's just how that life is. And if you haven't figured that out, by the time you're a high school prospect, you're through. I mean, it's just, you have no chance,
you're done.
Right? You're done. Exactly. Perfectly said.
You're done.
And so a guy like Russell, and he talks about this, and I mentioned this in previous times when this thing would come up. When he came out of USF, unlike Wilt, who took the money, left Kansas and shit, because, you know, Wilt was money-centric. No, he had a lot of commercial real estate. He was real smart. That crib he designed in the hills of L.A. off the chain and shit, you know, no question. And he designed it, which shows his brilliance. And he was a good businessman. But Russell talked about when he was before Chamberlain, Saperstein, right, the so-called founder of the Harlem Globetrotters, two guys out of Chicago, right?
Yep.
He called him Harlem because he thought that was a black thing, even though they started out of Chicago. And so the thing is, Saperstein showed Russell, he wanted Russell to join the squad. And the first thing he showed Russell was just a catalog of, when they go on European troops, of scantily clad women. And I'm scantily just being nice, right? And being nice. And he told, and Russell, direct quote, direct verbiage, said that Saperstein told him, you can have all of this. Not what your salary's going to be, not what your contract's going to be, the side bullshit. So in other words, they always know that if they throw that at you, go for it, that's going to be your downfall. And we
come
see
on.
It
there
at nauseam. So they know, being Patino at Louisville, bringing the hoes and the hookers to the campus for the young guys coming through. We see that, you know, when Spike threw that shit out there and he got game. This is going on forever. And so the thing is, Russell refused that. He said when Saperstein did that, he went out the side door. He just bounced. Didn't talk money. Didn't talk contract. Just let him know, partner, express all the nookie he could have.
Bill Russell
and
did more.
Rules.
Bill Russell did more for civil rights and pulling that move than most folks realize. The civil talks don't even exist anymore. You know, they crack attitudes caught up with them. And, of course, the move to Atlanta, that's a two-hour discussion by itself. But the guy's desire to keep St. Louis white with McCauley and Hagan was so strong.
And
Bob
Pettit.
Cleo Hill, Fred, and as
and
well.
Bob Pettit, that motherfucker's still going. He's still out there.
And
he's quiet.
Quiet as it was, Pettit, they functioned. They got one ring out of it. But overall, I'll take 11 rings to one, won't you?
So the bottom line was
St. Louis failed, and that racism did them in. They'll never say that, but that's essentially what happened.
Well, but well, like the NFL, they never say it, but we know it.
I mean, that was Russell's rookie year, the only championship. They may lost to St. Louis, the only championship they ever lost.
Yeah, in fact,
58, I believe. And the thing is that, you know, because he was a left-hander, there was a dude named Neil Johnston, who was like an NBA scorer, like journeyman type and shit.
Right.
And Russell came in late. He must have blocked his shot like 10 times in a row. They didn't do block shot statistics when Russell and Taylor played.
Russell,
It would be beyond astronomical what their totals would be. I mean, Russell's second all-time in rebounds. Chamberlain is absurd. But their rebounding statistics are just excessively high.
And people don't realize about Russ now, but we should mention, of course, we know when Kareem got with UCLA, they widened the lanes and cut out dunking. You know they also widened the lanes for Russell and Kyle in situations also. People don't understand.
Yeah. Wilt was the first lane widener, and then Wilt was also eliminated the goaltender. With Kareem, they outruled the dunk because, it was just vicious what he was doing to – I mean, they played the freshmen. I mean, UCLA was number one in the nation, and during those years, the freshmen didn't play varsity, you know?
Yes, that's right.
Allen and them guys played – yeah, they played – the freshmen team played the varsity. They beat the varsity by, like, 30, and the varsity was
number one in the nation.
Number two in the Westwood campus for sure, you know. And so, again, you know, a guy like Russell, you know, who I heard this one guy, he sits across from Shannon Sharp, I'll leave it at that, was talking about how good a shooter Russell was. My father always talked about Russell getting shoot for shit. And he was not a good shooter. That's a fact. You know what I mean? He was not a good shooter. You know, he run the lane and he failed. That's why he averaged around 15,
but
the ultimate team player.
But you know, the other thing I noticed, Eric, I made it a point to watch a lot of film, whatever stuff I could find on YouTube. They always talk about the Celtics fast break, so to speak.
Yes.
Either always filling nose, either starting it, and in main instances finishing it.
So when you look at those years, right, look at the years again, right, so as USF won in 56, 57, right, During that time frame, Tennessee State won 57, 58, 59. Mm-hmm. Kansas with Will went to the championship in 57, lost to Carolina, right, in that UNC. Mm-hmm.
Triple overtime.
And so, mm-hmm. Right. So in college basketball, yeah, Coach McGlinden, you know, setting the table with the three national championships, USF going back-to-back at that level, and then Wilt, you know, making his debuts into that whole realm. That caused a whole paradigm shift in the whole hoop thing. And RBAC generated and created the fast break basketball from the father of the fast break, Coach John McGlinden, who he studied.
Mm-hmm.
And he needed the trigger man to run his fast break because he knew that would work, and it had to be Russell. But he had to base that off on that system of what was hot at the time, and whatever is hot is working. And what was hot at the time was that TSU hoop fast break transition style, right?
Mm-hmm.
So everyone notices that shit because the basketball community is very small, right? It was wide and expansive.
At that time.
Right. Even now, you know, I mean, right, even now, you know, people, you know, I mean, I know, you know, people across the country in basketball who move through different parameters, it seems wide open, but it can link up pretty fast, right, to the right networks and shit, you know. Like any sport, like the NFL, right, it looks broad and big. If you got the right context to the league, you know the hell what's going on with the league. And you don't have
Absolutely.
To be fucking Adam Schefter. You know what I'm
saying? The only difference between the West Coast offense and the offense that the Vikings ran in the 70s is that the 49ers won their Super Bowls, the Vikings lost their Super Bowls.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the brother, I thought about, thanks for saying that, that's a great thought. What was the brother's name that Coach Willie Cotton and Jerry Rice in college at Mississippi Valley State?
Archie Cooley.
All right. So Bill Walsh is somewhere, Louisiana, Mississippi, scouting doing something.
He told us to go to
HBCU game. And Jerry Rice is just shredding shit. And so he literally turned Montana into Willie Cotton.
Uh-huh.
He just hybrided his shit on the NFL system, but he was running Archie Cooley's offense.
Just like they were stealing Jake Gaither's offense back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
And you know what they do? They mask it so well. It's kind of like if you're a musician, you know, and you know someone stole your hook, you know, and you can get those copyrights against them. Like when hip hop first started, they were just using everybody's shit. Then they started getting sued, and then they had to start paying people in advance, right? You could take a James Brown bass line on the funky drummer, which has been sampled more times than anything in hip hop, right?
Come on.
And just run a reverb on a certain drop ad nauseum and change the flow, except the people who do the funky drummer know it every damn time. They can match it real well to us, but they know their stuff. That's what they would do with Archie Cooley. They would chink that shit in NFL style. Our back would chink. You can't hide the fast break when the person's known the father of the fast break and you're running the fast break system.
Absolutely.
And no one ever used the term until this was created. They won 8 in a row because the template was set when Tennessee State won 3 in a row. They modified the shit, used the same championship so they could get 8 in a row, but it's always off the mind of Coach McLennan.
There you go.
And if someone tells me Mike D'Antoni's 3 second
offense or some shit. You know what's wild about that, T Mac? They call that the 7 second offense bullshit. You know what's funny about that? You know what Coach McLennan's mindset was? 4 seconds.
He's not even stealing it correctly.
When Black Magic pulled out that, right. But you never do you never do steal it, right, though. You never do steal it. I love that. Yeah, you never can sample it, right? I mean, you see these guys trying to, you know, can anyone teach being on the one like James Brown?
Nobody.
Yep.
Nobody.
Exactly. Movements are flashing his hand, letting them find and shit. You know, while he's right on stage. He's finding their ass on the stage once they get off on the run.
Put it this way. The next, you know, in my best Yosemite Sam voice, the next damn Yankee that tries to tell me that Glenn Miller was better than Charlie Parker, gonna get their head blown off.
That's right. You don't even listen to it.
So Russell and these brothers in the era they came in, time is important because it wasn't as many teams that we have now, right? That and all the different coverages and three-on-three bullshit, right? I mean, they had all these just really down low. So if you were successful and winning national championships, and Chuck Taylor is the one that, you know, set it up so that – brothers and HBCUs could compete to go to the NAI tournament, you know, because Coach Relinda the favorite and Chuck Taylor, the Mr. Chuck Taylor, the motherfucker still wearing Chuck Taylor conference today. All that to link, because what did the Celtics wear when they were playing all them championships?
No Air Jordans. There wasn't even any ground chucks. It was just,
No leggings, no sleeves, yeah. Right? None of that.
No waste management.
Fans can smoke in the arena, so you're consuming nicotine and shit while you're running up and down the floor inside the damn building.
The guard,
you know what I'm saying?
That's true.
Our back is firing up Bob Marley level cigar blunts on the sideline.
Oh yeah.
No title, no prize.
Giving a fuck. He got Russell on his team. He's firing up stogies. I got Russell. Give me another stogie. But he's got that whole system framework. All that time frame is all interlinked together of how they organized that system because the basketball community knew what worked. Arbeck got it. He needed that brother who could run that style out of the South. Louisiana, Monroe, Cat, Russell. Game over. He just got the white boys in line, Sherman and Cousy in them, and it was over.
It's like the Packers power sweep. You know it's coming.
Yeah.
Everybody and their mama know it's coming.
You can't do nothing.
You got to stop it.
Yeah, I can stop it.
Vincenzo Lombardi, the brother out of Sicily. You know, you know, the dude coach, every sport.
Money.
Uh-oh, hit the baseline. Philadelphia Soul.
More money.
We interrupt this for the love of money moment to throw some facts at you that you may relate to. Now, earlier during the incarnation of the Bachelor Pad, we've had several NFL players on to talk about getting them their just desserts because they put the work in, and it should make some of these benevolent dictators grateful with some compensation in the form of cash rather than an attaboy and a pat on the back. One of the ones we interviewed was one Lifford Hobley, who played with the Miami Dolphins. Now, Hobley told us that during the Miami Dolphins' perfect year, when he went 17-0, there were guys on the Redskins, on the Washington team, I only say that because that's what the name of the team was,
there it is,
who were making less than $20,000. Now, this is 1972. In 1972, I was just finishing my senior year in high school. I worked for the post office, and I was making a little over $20,000 a year.
It's only working at the post office.
How much money were you guys making back then? And I only bring this up because Tony and I were chopping it up on Monday. And do you realize, Tony, was it Kansas City or Matthew Stafford, that boy, shit, and the Rams, who were getting $150,000 a man from the latest Super Bowl?
Well, see, here's the thing. And this is all courtesy of the NFL record book, the newest one, which is out now, because I think the season starts tomorrow, at least the exhibition season starts tomorrow. January 15th, 1967. Of course, that's the date of Super Bowl I. The losing squad, your Kansas City your Kansas City Chiefs, were won $7,500. Meanwhile, the world champion Green Bay Packers won $15,000.
Right.
Now let's go up to Super Bowl, this past Super Bowl in February.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The losing team, the Cincinnati Bengals, to a man, $75,000 to every 53-man roster that either played or suited up on Super Bowl Sunday. And oh, by the way, for the LA Rams, the champions, the defending champions, they made $150,000 a man to win that Super Bowl. Now the thing you have to understand is, in those early years, from 67 to, what are we doing here, till about 1978, when the Dallas Cowboys defeated the Denver Broncos in Super Bowl XII, $15,000 for the winner, $7,500 for the loser.
Yep.
And then gradually it became $18,000. And then, this is for the winner, $18,000 became $36,000. $36,000 became $42,000. $42,000 became $58,000. And then there was a period from, I'll make sure I get this correctly, when the New England Patriots beat the Philadelphia Eagles that first time that they played. New England took home $68,000. Meanwhile, the Eagles had to spell E-A-G-L-E-S with just a mere $36,000. But it started a trend because it went from 68 to 73 to 78. To 83, to 88, to 92, and the first six-figure Super Bowl, believe it or not, it was the 50th. The Denver Broncos were the first Super Bowl champs to take home $100,000 for winning the Super Bowl. Now the Carolina Panthers had to slum along for just $51,000, but that's
poor
the thing from. From the time that Denver became the first six figure, it went from 107,000 to 112,000 to 118,000 to 124,000 to 130,000 for those cheating ass Buccaneers. The year that you had the M. Night Shyamalan, Steven Spielberg extravaganza that got them to the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it culminates the last year with $150,000. Now, I'm not one to gossip, but...
Oh, no, I know.
How does a non-profit organization do this kind of...
Which is no longer, you know, Congress nuclear bombed the nonprofit shit about 4 or 5 years ago. I mean, I guess we harped on it too hard back then. So, you know, they've moved away from that tax association. They're no longer considered that. But it's still chicken feed, though. I mean, based on what the owners are making.
Yes.
I mean, you know, chicken fucking feed. You know, I mean, and that's where the focus has got to continue to be, is in the ownership, because, you know, I mean, 150K, like, let's look at it from a business standpoint. Say you own a house and you can refinance your house and do a refi cash out or pull 150K out, right? Or, you know, home values have increased and you sell it with 150K. If you've never had money before, that seems like money, but do the math. If a person makes $15,000 a year, that's 10 years of salary in a lump sum. You can't live off that shit. It's just a quick payout, you know. And so if the owners are netting way above that, we can't be like these sorry-ass buffoon motherfuckers. Every time we hear dollar signs and shit, we shake our ass. I mean, that's chicken feed. You know, I mean, it's cool that you do what you do and get paid for it, but it's really low-ball money with the sponsorships. Well, what did NFL collect, like $20 million a second and shit for advertising or something? That's pauper pay when you move to those levels. It only appears like it's astronomical if you base it on, you know, a Walmart greeter's income or some shit, you know, which is a poverty mindset. And a poverty mindset oohs and ahs on every time they hear a dollar figure if they haven't carved out their own roadmap to get broken off their damn self, which is what the thought process should be. You know what I mean? So these players who get it, remember, how does that pay? Remember, the salaries are typically paid, again, GM hat time, over the course of the season, right? So in other words, if you're an NBA team real quickly or NFL team, the moment the season ends, depending on how you decided to get paid, your pay ends. That's why you hear the per game. You hear the per game income, right? Oh, he's got to spend 10 games. He's going to lose X amount. Usually, it's a, you know, if you're not playing, unless you want to prorate your income for the rest for a full year, when you can, you have that option. Usually, when the season's over, it's over. Cats don't want to do that shit. They don't prorate. They want their money up front now. They figure it's enough, right? So walk with me here.
Unless you're Bobby Bonilla, but that's a whole other story.
We're talking about an active play, not deferred compensation, right? Which is another story. Because there's a bunch of other players getting deferred compensation too. Hit them up every time, Bobby. But Bobby's done shit for no. We don't know what the hell Bobby's doing with his money. We're still waiting for Michael Jordan's investment to the black community too after the George Floyd story. But that's another story. But keeping it moving.
Tony, what happened was when I did the interview years ago with Paul Tagliabue, when he decided NFL was going to make the Super Bowl a holiday, which they have, the money began to accumulate to the point where that could be paid. They knew that was coming. And like you said, the numbers are astronomical for the average person. But you know, that's lunch money, and most guys get that money to their girlfriends or their wives that day.
Patrick, to your point, real quickly, to order lunch money. I know for a fact I had, you know, I mean, many. I'm gonna just word it this way. My boys that went to the league, right? They can show me a pay stub for that shit for a month.
Thank you. A pay stub,
depending on some of the salaries that some of them were getting. And they were still bitching there wasn't enough money for certain other factors. I wanted to cover this, though. So when you get that income and the pay's done, right, regular season's over, you don't pre-reach your income, that's why playoff money means something, right, because that's extra cheese. If you don't make the playoffs, you don't get that loot. The owners racked up on ticket money.
Before a game is ever played, regular season ticket holders,
owners can't wait. They want that playoff, man. They want those home games, man. They want that home field advantage, man.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and that's where, because their only schedule, they're going to alternate, Patrick, 9-8, just the 17-game season, 8-1-year, 9-8, 8-year, flip-flop.
Yep.
Okay. And so they're going to get about, what, 9 games maximum a year.
Mm-hmm.
They need them 2 revenue streams from those 2 home games so they can get to the playoffs, you know. And
Now, the only thing about Super Bowl is, guys, if you're in the Super Bowl because of the various streams, and I mean streams like the Niagara Falls, of money put out, players can make that money do other things. I don't care.
That's what they take on the advertisements, right, or wear a hat and shit from the sponsor, the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so no,
mm-hmm.
it pays to win at every level. But the thing, again, finance hat. All right, you got your salary, so you, that playoff money's cheese, right? That's good
yep.
cheese, plus you're going to get being a champion creates a whole nother level of marketing for you because you
yep.
can go through your whole life saying you're a Super Bowl champ. You watch these ESPN shows where someone goes a two-time Super Bowl champ, this motherfucker played special teams. Fuck, I mean, I don't remember him balling.
That's right.
But he was on the team that won twice, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so
I give you a perfect example. Rich Diana here from Hamden, Connecticut, played at Yale, you know, all Ivy League and all that other stuff, did, I believe, 2 years in the league with the Miami Dolphins. He just happened to be a special teams guy on that Miami Dolphin team that lost to the Washington team the year of the strike.
Yep.
He basically retired after that, and he's been a practicing MD since then.
I mean, there were things like Robert Horry, seven-time NBA champ. He averaged 7.5 for his career.
Yeah.
Hey,
yep.
So, the right shot,
you know,
the right time, but he's
and that's cool though. So here it is. You just so how was that? How did he classify and claim the Super Bowl winning money? It's got to be 1099 and shit. The salary's been paid.
I'm guessing it's got to be like that now
it's got to be a bonus, and bonus is like 40% tax and shit.
Well, see, here's the thing.
So you're gonna net 60 out of that 100, and that's on the first end of the tax wave. So, you know, you're not netting that shit. So, in other words, 150, my mind goes net. If that was in Cali and you played out here in the Super Bowl, and that you make money in the state of California, not Texas, because the Super Bowl wasn't in no income state, Texas or Florida, Louisiana, if you're playing New Orleans. So you're going to get hit up. You're going to get hit up on those taxes. And if you come to Cali, oh, you're getting fucking nuclear war. The difference
NFL
professional sports, real quickly, last point. Last point to that. Professional sports owners, you write athletes off as depreciation. They are material objects to the business.
Yes.
Physical.
And
that's
not the only business.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Because, see, here's the thing.
In other words,
here's the thing.
A computer at a business, the way they file that, same thing they
that's
do with
right.
the personnel of sports.
Exactly.
No different.
Yeah. Exactly. And, see, the crazy thing is that 150 that the Rams allegedly made, hell, because it was in California, a couple of special teams guys probably owe the state of California some money.
Yep.
They probably do. 150 times 53 times the 10 men in the taxi squad, you're talking about roughly $90 million overall in payout. But each team in the league,
if you're not on the active roster, you're going to vote for your share. They're going to vote for your share. That shit ain't divvied up 100% for everybody. That's the other mythological.
That's true.
When people tune in to hear this stuff, they don't want us to go to these kiss ass, throw a money figure out there without us breaking down what that really effing means.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
To go back to
what Lippert said about, what did you say, Mike? The player that players in 72 average what was the average salary of 18?
$18,500.
Now again, according to the whatever, the Dolphins that went undefeated and won that year, they won $15,000. So in a sense, it was a bonus. Or in some instances, it was just basically not even an extra game check. It was just sort of here's a little something to wet your beef.
Jethro Pugh was making $17,500.
That time the Packers had to roll.
Yeah,
when they won so many that their playoff checks were pretty much added to their balances, to their accounts, their budgets. The Yankees did the same thing. Actually, the movie 61 highlighted that they were all talking about, don't mess with my playoff share. They knew what they were talking about. But the
Jethro Pugh made 17.5 when they played the Super Bowl against the Dolphins. Dwayne Thomas was like, Jethro getting 17.5. He said he went to Bob Lilly. He said, yo, Bob Lilly. He said, Bob, man, Kefro's getting 75. You've been an all pro. You've been balling out. What you getting? 25.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Which why my players getting every damn they can get. Every damn you can get. I have no problem. Mm-hmm. Not one penny. Mm-hmm. Because
hey,
every damn
they
make, Otis making 10.
I'll say it before. I'll say it again. For player X to make X amount of money, the team has got to be bringing in
Thank you very much.
The moment you sign up, the moment you sign a player, the moment you sign a player for
$200,000, the moment you sign a player for a
$200 million contract, baseball or whatever, people oohing on shit. The owner put $200 million to the community, and he wiped $200 million off his book.
Why do you think Mike Rizzo? Why you think Mike Rizzo was smiling his ass off at the news conference the other day when they traded Soto?
Oh hell
yeah!
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he basically just had his Geico. You know, I just saved so much on my reinsurance with Geico. I just
because when he bought that franchise, he took on a hell of a lot of debt. So you got to start cutting costs. I mean, Oakland A's do that shit all the time. They'll torture burn their team every single time, and everyone leaves, because right, Mr. Billy B, he's still over there, you know.
He's still over there,
and the thing
and
is,
the right name, Eric. B is the right name, B.
Yeah, really.
Right.
They're Walmarts that have better higher rates of paying than some of the A's, for Christ's sake.
You look at the Padres lineup right now after all these trades,
Lord Jesus.
And their bank accounts are murderers row. Fernando Tatis Jr., Luis Soto, Manny Machado, Josh Bell, Will Myers,
Lord Hammers.
Profar, I mean, from at least two to seven, it's poison.
By the way, Mike, it was a sellout tonight, by the way.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the
Padres are the last one left, right? The Chargers lead town, so it's the Padre town, you know.
Yeah,
exactly.
Their
whole
town.
And I was telling Mike earlier, if we got Tatis and you got Machado and Soto, I don't care who you are, even my Dodgers, one of the three guys going to get you.
Mike, I'm having a Henry Hawk moment. One of these guys, I'm saying one of these guys.
Okay. The Padres are so geared out right now.
I know.
Well, put it this way: if there's ever a year where the Padres are gonna kick their cross reference their cross town rivals in the nuts, this is the year. Those are nuts.
But think about the money. The Padres had to spend $500 million right off the top just to get this lineup. It's supposed to mean they're gonna win a championship. Now, we saw other owners spend this kind of money before. We saw Moreno spend it with the Angels. We saw the guy in Baltimore spend the Angelos. George has always spent it, never thought twice about it. You know, now San Diego has decided they're going to go all in and push their chips in, and this is going to get them a championship. Even if they get a championship out of it, they won't break even for the year. As far as I know, unless all of a sudden they're bringing in three million fans like the Dodgers.
Here's the sweet part of it for them. Soto is not salary. He's got to do either salary arbitration or take, dare I say it, the league minimum, so to speak. But he'd re-up this year. With Washington, what was it, 25, 26 mil, I believe, somewhere around in there. Yeah. So basically, they put it this way. They got him this year, and then the 2 years after that. Even if they
right.
just win one World Series, they'll make mm-hmm. their money. They'll make
oh,
their
yeah.
money.
Well, I mean, these guys are not stupid. I mean, they're
oh,
still going to be in a they're still going to be in a profit margin because of those TV contracts. That's always
mm-hmm.
the elephant in the room. Now these guys can get greedy and not say, well, you know, we don't want to just spend none of that loot. They got the loot. And plus what they've done, because they've gotten a little bit real attractive to the younger crowd, you know what I mean, with
mm-hmm.
the Padres. Merch
mm-hmm.
sales go up, you
yes,
know,
indeed.
And
exactly.
they become
mm-hmm.
a bigger draw, and then
mm-hmm.
they control that entire lower region of Southern California. Mexico is
mm-hmm.
right below San Diego, you know, and so that whole
mm-hmm.
crowd there, getting Hispanic
mm-hmm.
star players, also creates the buzz. But then there's two things they got in their favor: merch, you know, because their merch
mm-hmm.
is hot right now,
and
as well
as
those TV contracts.
And that's well did 30 years ago.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you still have people who are Dodger fans from Mexico strictly because of Fernando, and he's still with the team on radio.
LA is predominantly Hispanic, for the record.
Yes,
anyway, so they're
yeah.
always going to have that.
Absolutely.
San Diego, even more so. I mean, Tijuana, you could just hop shock
yeah.
through that shit in 5 seconds, you know.
And gentlemen, let me throw something to really throw the wrench into it. We know about solar situation. Wait till you see the numbers of the Japanese kid with the Angels.
Ohtani.
You see the money he gets.
Because of the large Asian community in SoCal, as well as globally. See, baseball is a global market. So, in other
mm-hmm.
words, they're not just getting revenue streams.
The mm-hmm.
They're just not getting
yep.
revenue streams from here. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing is, it's like, oh, no, they baseball's cash rich because they throw the money. They throw them salaries out at there. The only ones not paying attention to it are the baseball's cash rich. The only ones that's not paying attention to it is the people who want to push the NFL, you know, basketball monikers because they can't talk baseball and shit. And plus, they're
mm-hmm.
obligated to do so because they have those TV contracts.
That's
that
right.
They have to talk.
Mm-hmm.
They control it. The NFL and the NBA control those talk shows. They
that's
finance
exactly
those
right.
stuff. They control those. There's the NBA
mm-hmm.
and the NFL's as bitches.
Eric,
yes.
mm-hmm. the next question. With what the Padres just did, does mm-hmm. that make San Diego a large market team or a small market team?
A large
well,
market
when they,
team.
Pete Game. So when they play the World Baseball Championships, right, it comes to San Diego. That thing is
mm-hmm.
hot, that World Baseball thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It
that
is.
World Baseball tournament is dope, man, if you ask me, man. Watching that Global Baseball thing, and they played out in
mm-hmm.
San Diego. Matter of fact, during the pandemic, who hosted a lot of those games? San Diego did.
San Diego and Miami are slated to get it to get half of it this year.
That's my point. And it's a revenue stream, so San Diego's turning into such a baseball hubbub, right? It's a coastal
exactly.
city, all that stuff like that. But they're not stupid, man. They're, in other words, when you look at a strategic map of, like, the sports, you know, one thing, no one has more sports teams than Cali, cumulatively, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so
exactly.
the thing
absolutely.
Is, it's like, you know, what's the most southern base? So they got to strengthen their team. So you get San Diego, you know, no Randy Jones, you know, Gary
mm-hmm.
Templeton, you know, Colbert and them dudes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
working the ugly-ass uniforms
no Tony
and shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tony Gwynn. You know, Tony Gwynn, rest in power, my brother. I mean,
yeah.
the only cat I know that looked like a brother, but when he talked, man, my God, Fred Astaire. And so the whole thing.
And he knew it.
Yeah, and he was 100%. He was 100% of San Diego here because he played a San Diego State. I always thought with Tony, if he just took 3 inches off his midsection, he would have hit 500.
That's a thought. But he
maybe again. Now, what's his superpower? Because he was a hell of a hitter. But the thing is, San Diego's hot, man. But baseball operates in the so-called Jesus, man, they're laughing at everybody because they're getting paid out there.
Yes, yes. And the key, like we said previously, they're the only thing in town.
Exactly.
See, that's the thing. That's the thing because, see, being that only team, they're going to, you know, hell, you may get some pissed off Giant A's Dodger fans.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
So the Lakers, right? The Lakers had signed this astronomical deal years ago for cable rights. Only in L.A.,
yes.
Right? And so
yes.
No one else, no other city, just L.A.
Crazy.
San Diego can hold, hypothetically, I don't know who's down there, but just say they can hold Fox Sports San Diego hostage for fees to cover their
games. It's Bally's now. It's no longer Fox for some freaking reason.
Exactly,
I don't know why it's Bally's. I don't get that at all.
So the Padres decided to just, you know, spend a little bit of that cachet they have to double their cachet.
And let me add this to it. If I'm in the San Diego Padres organization, I'm in their front office, and I'm in there. I'm the vice president of marketing. I'm picking who I want. I don't care who comes from. It ain't like me going out looking for business. You got to come to me.
Exactly. No, you got it like that. Yeah, you got it like that, man. You got it like that. In other words, if you decided to put your urn out the window, they'd be all lining up. So, you know, first. That's how it is.
There you go.
Based on that market-based thing, and you're correct. But these guys are smart, man. I mean, the money that moves in these parameters, the way they build income, the way they reinvest, they just break these guys up, and they're not taking the hit on that money. And remember, it's also, when did you take on that contract? What time of year was it? So you're not getting a full year of taking on that contract when you file your taxes. You pick it up where you took it at the time. So you're the seventh month of the – you're in the seventh month of this year, eighth month, right, August. So what, baseball may push to October – you know, you may be carrying that contract 3 months.
Right.
And then Washington picks it up the other five.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
People have got to see
yeah.
that match. The match, these guys are moving. These guys are playing with some huge chips. And they want everyone to be stupid at locking on player salaries and player little investments.
Oh, please,
they're the last
please.
Ones. And that's why a guy like Mayweather was pimping the shit out of all of that. You know, 80 million.
Yeah, absolutely.
A fight.
Mm. Interesting dialogue, gentlemen. That takes us to final thought. Time is caught up with us big time. Gary, if you get a chance, get your ass back in here. But for now, Patrick, please throw something in the pot.
Gentlemen, it's been a tough week. Two things I'm going to go into very quickly. When I heard that Vince Scully died, I teared up because you know, his voice for me is a lifetime of baseball. Again, sitting in my daddy's lap, and when I got too big, he put me on the couch, and I watched the Dodgers when I was a kid, and he heard the voice of Vince Scully, that guy from little kid in Brooklyn to now. So knowing that he's gone, I reflect on him. I reflect on my time sitting with my dad.
Right.
And the other part was I was in college. I stopped playing ball. I was working, and going to school because my pops couldn't afford it anymore. And I was pledging the same time. So making a long story short, we had a guest come to the university. We had a speakers program at Ohio State, which is what everybody you can name. I'm not going to name that folks came in. So the speaker came in and spoke that evening and on life. And everybody was intrigued about what was being said. After that, we went to a function in Morrow Tower. Morrow Tower was in the center of back of Ohio State. It was two 11-story towers of Morrow Lincoln Tower of dormitories. Stories like that are legendary. So we went to the gathering room, and the gathering room, the guest came over and we talked. Everybody was enamored with the guest, and I had to say something to the guest. So I walked over to the guy and I said, "Look, you know, I didn't particularly like, you know, the team that you played for, but you won so many championships. How did you win?" So as we were talking, and about 8-9 yards of what we were talking, there was this broad window in the gathering room where you could look out over the whole campus of Ohio State. And he said, I tell you what, right now I will give you $1,000 cash if you could dribble that ball, a ball basketball to that window faster than I can throw it. I was stunned and didn't say much after that. The person I was talking to was Bill Russell, because Bill Russell was president of the captain. And he changed my mind that day about playing basketball. Ball movement and intellect. And
I
was blessed to talk to him at that short period of time as a pledge. And Captain Man, fine nuke to him, used to Golden Shores. Another man I teared up when I heard he passed. Tough one.
Right on, brother. Beautiful story.
Transition.
Mm-hmm. Professor, throw something in the pot, please.
Well, first, you know, like everybody else, I pay homage to Bill Russell. And since he's not an HBCU guy, I'll just say I honor him as much as a person, as a player, as well as a player. He was a good friend of a friend. And we all know how close he was with Sam Jones. And we're working on some things now to honor the high school from North Carolina and possibly South Carolina also. And, you know, but the first thing I thought about when I heard that he had passed, all these people, well, who's your top five? Who's your top ten?
Oh, please.
And,
thank you.
And I told
about
him, I don't
for?
Do it.
Yeah, who's about what for?
You know, I say, you know, I don't pick people like that. He said, well, you know all about, I say, yeah, that's why I can't pick, because, okay, if you got centers, so you're going to leave off Russell because he didn't play on ESPN. Oh, you're going to leave off Willis Reed. You're going to leave off Willis.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yep.
And by the time I kept naming until just centers, we had about nine guys. Which
mm-hmm.
one of them are you going to leave off? Oh, that's going to be hard. No, that's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we got to, you know, we got to get away from that nonsense, because it breaks down some things that really violates the quality of the people that we produce. And when the mouse wasn't looking, you see the kind of stuff we're looking at is, you know, we got to understand this man. I bet you that they lost it to film for this this interview. The one time he was interviewed and they were asking about getting the ball off the rim and that kind of stuff. Say, well, you know, we just got to understand. He would say, you just got to understand the laws of physics. And the guy's
uh-huh.
mouth dropped open.
Uh-huh.
He said, what do you mean, laws of physics? He said, the laws of physics. I took physics. Because, see, they don't realize this man was an honor student as well as he was an honor basketball player. And, you
uh-huh.
know, he
yeah, it's
he,
about mind
he,
power.
He can rebound that one or two shots that Mr. Jones might miss from outside, you know, always banking, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, the sports encyclopedias are selling very well, so want some, get some. www.sportsencyclopedias.com.
Best seller. Sell them all.
Always.
Awesome.
It's just a push of a button to get more of them printed.
Facebook page? Off your Facebook page?
Excuse me?
Fred, off your Facebook page, the ordering?
You can on Facebook.
Do you order off your website or just social media?
You can also order off the website.
What's your website for the world?
www.blackheritageview.com. Buy books.
Black Heritage Review, one word, correct?
Correct.
One phrase, BlackHeritageReview.com.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Mm-mm-mm. Nothing like it. Eric, since you started, finish it, sir. Throw something in the pot.
I feel you, my brother. Wow. You know, I mean, good dialogue, man. You know, we have a lot of rich history, and it's all based on relevance. couple of things. You know, we've been talking about, you know, we talk HBCU. I think, you know, very poignant messages with Mr. Scalia. Again, you know, I always enjoyed his class. I mean, he'd have bobblehead night, you know, many times as a Dodger announcer, never mentioned it was bobblehead night for him, you know, which is another level. All these guys, you know what I'm saying, another level. You know, all these guys who don't, you know, he'll talk about, you know, a soccer reference and then tell you how that soccer reference all developed and who initiated the shit. So he was always educating as well. You know, Mr. William Felton Russell, wow, you know, grew up in a basketball rich household, and the stories, we don't have enough time, but it was always unique how it always centered around the intellect and not the statistics. A couple of things. In 1962, it was interesting, you know. In 1962, Major League Baseball had their All-Star game in Washington Senators stadium at the time. Now they're in the Nationals. Mm-hmm. There were the Senators back then. You know, John Fitzgerald Kennedy threw out the first ball, you know, for that game, for the All-Star game, since it was in the nation's capital. And the starting catcher, you know, for the American League was a black man named Earl Batty.
Earl Batty.
Batty. I call it Earl Batty. Yeah. His brother named Earl Batty started. And backstop catcher. Now, we know about Campy, Campanella, and other brothers, but no one talks about the great, great Earl Batty. So a statistic, which is, again, I like the uniqueness of statistics. When you talk batting average, home runs, all that. He picked off 15 runners that year. Picked off from the squatting position, way before Pudge Rodriguez turned it out. Earl Batty was the first brother to do so. The fans voted him in to be the starting catcher for the American League for three consecutive years, a black man. Uh-huh. And he was there. And then what was unique about 1962 in Major League Baseball, they would play two All-Star games. They had the second one in Chicago.
That's right.
They had the second one in Chicago. And so Earl Batty played with another brother named Paul Wagner, nicknamed Daddy Wags.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was an All-Star player. Daddy Wags. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, nowadays Daddy Wags may have a fleet on the block, but that's another story. But Daddy Wags, right? You know what I'm saying? You know, Daddy Wags and Earl Batty were brothers. Daddy Wags went to Tuskegee University. You know, and he was an All-Star baseball player, HBCU. Early 60s, you know, he was doing it. Earl Batty, after he retired from the Major League Baseball, went to Bethune-Cookman to finish his degree, and then he ended up being Bethune-Cookman's basketball coach.
All right.
All right. And so I just wanted to share the HBC baseball history. And the final note to that, you know, ESPN has been pushing, and I've always liked the brother's game and how he's been able to ball with the site guy, Derek Jeter. You know, it's been doing a little thing going here. You know what I'm saying? Can I be in the right field crowd? Derek Jeter. And so when that happens, so when that happens, you know, great shortstop, Jeter represented, you know, I mean, we all know his exploits. And he played shortstop. He fathered his father, who was the shortstop at Fisk University.
Tuskegee, yes.
Fisk. That's right. His father played ball at Fisk. He was an HBC or his daddy. So when you look at this legacy and these trends, and he talked about the legacy of HBCUs, someone asked Deion Sanders that question in an interview. You know, the sister from ESPN was sitting there with Jay Walker. Keep doing your work, Jay. you know, and Skywalker, right? And they were doing an interview, and she asked him about the legacy. And just DM, legacy? What are you talking about, legacy? I'm trying to feed these kids. And she was, and then Jay had to chime in. No. We're talking about the historical. So Earl Batty, great brother, catcher. He could have went anywhere. He's a major league star. He went to play with White Sox later. Went to get a citizen's degree at Bethune-Cookman. Became their basketball coach. Daddy Wags, Tuskegee University. Fisk University, smaller university, fathered Derek Jeter, one of the greatest ball players ever out of New York. That's what we're talking about, legacy. And this is in the game of baseball, not football, basketball. You can wax potter, or it's right there in your grill if you pull back the crates. But Earl Batty, look him up. Dope. Daddy Wags, Paul Wagner, look him up. And then Gene, again, you know, he inherited the throne from his father, who played shortstop and fifth.
Say, Mike. Say, Mike. Say, Mike.
Yes.
Say, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Can, Eric, have you seen the NYU Gods piece on Showtime?
Uh-huh.
Have you seen the documentary on NYU? Oh, you need to go watch it.
So the the documentary on?
On basketball gods or NBA point guards in New York City.
Oh, Sam God and them? Sam God and the brothers?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know what's wild about that is, like, having direct experience with literally, I mean, damn, fuck it. Might as well call it like it is. You know, Mark Jackson, seen him coming up. Kidding, when he came up, Archbishop
mm-hmm.
Malloy. There was a kid named Phil.
That's right.
Remember Steve the Animal Burt that played Iona?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes,
please. Iona.
Mm-hmm.
Iona.
Oh,
Georgetown Freddie Brown. You know, he was at Stevens. He played with Eddie Pinkney. And then there was a cat named Ernie Myers that played at NC State. And so, obviously, Pearl Washington, the Sham God, and these brothers. Sutton,
yep.
Sam Worthing with the Marquette. He
yep.
was dope, but he was a
mm-hmm.
point guard. Butch Lee.
That's right.
These brothers
yeah,
here.
Butch Lee.
So, yeah. So a lot of these guys, man, had, like, direct affiliations from that. Can't even think about them all when I thought Rory Sparrow, because he was out of Jersey, came to Paris.
Rory Sparrow.
Remember
yep.
Rory?
Been all
you know what I'm saying? And Rory had a long career, but they all learned the X and O game from the NYC level. Did obviously Rafer Austin skipped to my Lou and all the guys that came
yeah,
back later.
We talked about that. Uh-huh.
Over the time. But there was
check it out,
but,
man. Check it out.
Okay,
you'll
thank
be
you for
smile.
That, man. Yeah. Sam guy, don't sleep on him.
Oh, hey, he's making $15 an hour.
And
you guys got to do it.
I know. Thank you for that.
Yes,
thanks, Patrick.
Mike, I just want to remind Eric that Archie
uh-huh.
Cooley is a graduate of one of the schools on Jefferson Street. The big one.
The bigger one. AC too?
Yeah, he was
uh-huh.
actually starting center. He was a starting
wow.
center. Then the coach came up from Mississippi.
Got
Whoa.
It. Well, I mean, Machine Gun Totten and them, I mean, lost totally boosted that intel for his 49er team, just like Arback boosted the intel from Coach McGlinton.
So,
ain't nothing but
a bunch of thieves. Thieves.
Love that
Tony. Well, in modern day parlance, they call it ain't nothing but a gangster party.
Tony, put something in the pot.
The third, see not.
Well, unfortunately, the state of Connecticut is in martial law once again
yes.
because Miss Bucher's another ACL. Goodness
yes.
gracious, what is it with
somebody's
these ACLs,
man?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
crazy, and she's barely 12 years old. That's the crazy
yeah.
part about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's the thing. That's it. That's the, them's the breaks. That's the breaks, but
it's
going to be
Connecticut. Is it what lockdown?
They're in a martial law. I always thought about that. Well, because they've given up on the men's team, but everybody
okay,
you know, everybody
okay.
jumps on the women's team bandwagon
okay.
or
yes.
whatever, and you know like because they weren't supposed to make the run they made last year. They weren't so quote unquote supposed to make the run, so to speak, but. You know, they were able to, but see, now this is going to be a little
yeah.
bit of a setback. But just to piggyback, I guess, on the whole Padres thing, but if there's ever a time for them to kick Big Brother's ass, if they don't do it this year or within the next couple of years while they got Soto under contract, they will never do it. So the clock's ticking,
y'all.
Mm-hmm.
That's something to think about as the cash turn. No joke. Gentlemen, I want to thank you as always for excellent repartee tonight. Also want to thank Gary, wherever you are. Gary, say hi to Missy for me. There's you playing with the puppy. Everybody else is all cool. Before I go,
Mike, to be honest, what wound up happening is the A's needed a crafty left-hander for their game tonight with the Angels. So
yeah.
That's about right.
Yeah.
That's about
yeah.
right.
I forget about
yeah.
that. Sorry, Gary. to handle your business. But before I go, I want to give my ashe to a gorgeous sister. Stop me if you heard this before. Turn on the TV. There's a black person on. Well, this particular TV was on Star Trek because the young lady in the miniskirt who was giving orders to the console was a fine rascal.
Lord, have mercy.
The sister with the blue Chicago.
She was
married all the way up to her ass.
And she had her name changed. She had her name changed to Nichelle. She starred on Broadway in a few first and things. She did a movie. If you watch Truck Turner, you know who the limit is with a fine ass self. But aside from all of that, she was a bad sister. And she helped serve for a long time, voiceovers as well as playing Lieutenant Rule through all those movies. She finally carried on and became an ancestor at age 89. Was still fine at age 70.
Simba girl.
Did some pictures that a lot of folks did not get to see. But damn, did she look good. That's all I can say. So,
Mike, she can beam me up anytime.
And real quick to that point, Mike, there's a feature in the show, Nichols, I believe it's in the Peacock streaming channel, which talks about her impact in NASA space sciences.
That's right.
Oh, yes.
She's recruited for NASA.
There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
But in that black person on TV department, there was her, Gail Foster, who was Peggy on Mannix.
Gail Foster.
Leslie Adams, who was on Sing Along with Mitch. I mean, there were very, very few. Of course,
Christy Love.
Wait,
don't forget about Christy Love.
Wait, Mike. How can y'all forget about Denise Nicholas on 222?
Now, I didn't give me a chance to get to 222. But Bill Withers is too busy
getting
ass and stuff. But I digress.
I mean, all I can say to that is Florida Evans is wondering why y'all ain't mentioning her.
I got two words for Florida Evans. Judy Pace.
Oh, Isabel Sanford, we're sorry if you didn't get the first shout out.
You know what? If she didn't have 5 o'clock shadow at 7:15 every night, she would be on me. Maybe.
Ooh. To quote Mawanda Page, watch yourself. That's what was fine back in the day too. Anyway,
baby, thanks for the gift. It's got my name in it. Polyester.
I leave this bouquet for Nichelle and all the beautiful sisters. I got to throw Diane Tyler
in here. Yes, sir.
And Earl J. Wagadon. No, no, this is about Julia, baby. But yes, this is all the fine sisters and Nichelle. Better days, baby. Thank you for sharing your gifts with us. May you rest in power.
Captain's log, Stardate 14. We're being pulled towards a hostile planet. I'm hoping that Scotty will be able to activate the backup control system. Good, I feel so vulnerable.
Captain, I'm picking up some strange signals. Something about intergalactic oppressors, sir.
Captain, intruders are approaching the bridge, sir. Who are you?
I am the Minister Lewis Burke.
Spock, who is he? A former Calypso singer, Captain, who later became leader of a 20th century African-American religious sect known as the Nation of Islam.
You'd like to buy some incense?
Bean pie, my brother?
No, thank you.
What do you want?
I've come to warn your crew.
Warn your crew.
Of their enslavement.
Enslavement.
Aboard this vessel.
Mm-hmm.
That's poppycock. These people are perfectly free to do anything they like.
It is that same lie that kept Elvis the king. that made that poor child Latoya Jackson think she could sing. It is that same lie that's got white boys rapping and the fat boys acting.
Hey, mister, you can't come in here and talk to me like that. Uhura, get me Starfleet Command.
Yes, Captain.
Oh, my Nubian princess, how long have you placed his cause? I watch the show every week, and all I see is the back of your nappy wig.
Uhura, Starfleet, now!
Well, wait a second. He's right. I've been sitting here for 15 years with this damn thing in my ear. It ain't got one raise yet. Be your little secretary or your occasional chocolate fantasy. You get up off your flat butt and get Starfleet your damn self, because I ain't busting.
Yes, sister. Mr. Zulu, call Scotty. Tell him to get this man out of here.
Wait a minute, Mr. Zulu. Before you touch that dial, answer me this question. Who does the laundry around here?
You. Mr. Zulu.
Well, you call me Buddha Head and Pie Face in front of everybody.
Well,
I've been in space all this time, and I haven't had one woman yet. You even take the ugly ones, Captain. My loins are about to explode. I want to do the nasty.
That's right, rise above.
Mr. Spock, my friend, we've got to do something.
Why do you say we, Caucasoid? It's obvious, Captain, that Minister Farrakhan is right.
Spock, are you out of your Falcon mind?
Well, logically speaking, Captain, I am the strongest and most intelligent person aboard this vessel, yet I'm only second in command.
Mm-hmm.
I should be Captain, and I'm also a better director than you.
Can't you see it's discrimination?
You get off my ship, buddy.
Put your puny weapon down, Captain. You cannot harm me. My people have survived 400 years of slavery.
Slavery!
300
slavery.
Years of apartheid.
Apartheid!
And 25 years of the Jeffersons in syndication.
Go to your room.
Oh, I love it when I do that to them.
Nubian princess, call Sylvia's soul food shack, make reservations.
I got a taste for some blackened whitefish. Mr. Sulu, what are you gonna have?
Sylvia.
Well, all right then, my horny Asian brother, walk back to fire. We're going home, destination 125th Street.
Should also be noticed that in the early days of Star Trek, Michelle was considering leaving the show. She happened to come to an event where the Reverend Martin Luther King was speaking and had a chance to speak with him. Reverend said that Star Trek was one of the few shows he and Coretta allowed his kids to watch because there was a black person in a pivotal role. Michelle, of course, changed her mind about leaving the show, and the rest, they say, is history. But for now, we're going to be history, too. Anybody go safe, stay safe, be safe. We'll see you in Gary Show Saturday.